I'm in the field of dandelions, wishing on every word for you to be mine, mine. Wishing on dandelions all of the time, praying that one day, I'm in the street of dandelions, wishing on every word for you to be mine. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 23rd of the third month, 2026. It is a Monday evening and you are with yours truly. So ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking about depression at the workplace. We're talking about how to cope with, the reason that I wanted to talk about this was the fact that, I've seen many suicides go on and I've been analyzing and computing these people, and 90% of them are writing in their job, like they are writing in their notes, you know, they're saying things like, yeah, the money is not enough and I'm just so depressed and all of that and all of that. Like there's no way out, right? And I'm wondering, but how do we cope? Because I have a friend of mine that had major depression, right? But she's also bipolar. And one thing that happened was that she went into a state of depression for like 7 months or 8 months, 9 months, almost a year, right? Where she couldn't move. She just couldn't, like, once you get into that state, it's so hard to get out. And that's why you have to keep up with routines. You have to go if you don't want to, even if you don't want to go. You have to stand up even if you don't want to stand up. You have to come even if you don't want to. You have to try even if you don't want to. You just have to keep pushing even if you don't want to, right? So at the end of the day, she had resigned, right? And resigning is all our parents' biggest fear and all our friends' biggest fear and ourselves. That is the biggest thing, because we're looking at the economy right now and we're thinking that, like, there are no job opportunities, Jimmy. If you are playing with the work, if you are playing with the bread and butter moves on. It doesn't come back, and it doesn't, like, oh, I'm going to wait for you and all of that. The best that can happen is if you have a team that has a sense of understanding, and maybe, just maybe, right, you can survive for a little while. But all in all, it's more about pushing through. And that pushing through is the one that I'm looking at, and I'm wondering, do we know how to pull through? Because I've seen many of these NDF guys and these police guys and these sisters and all of these people. I've seen a lot, especially when the pension comes, right? You know, when you have worked for a couple of years and you're thinking that, yeah, when the pension comes, I've got a plan, right? That's when everybody's like, ah, nah, I'm so going through this, and I just don't wanna see anybody at work. I don't wanna go to work. So these are NDF people, and oh, aihe keremo, you understand? Ya kan tumbanga ande taihe keremo, taihe keremo, taihe keremo na na kuche ya atukatame ko business ayetu yo nguti, atukatame ko business ayetu yo masaga saga, shina kulonge man geshingwengi koto pe 1 million maro hadimbo kucha pe opuna no let's hope opuna no shike opuna entre popo opuna umahanga no agenga no tagi. As soon as the money falls into me, you understand? And a lot of us forget that. A lot of us forget that we are in debt. And even if we are not in debt per se, a lot of us act on impulse when we are not feeling well. We act on impulse and we just jump. But how are we going to manage this thing? Because I feel like many of us are going through this depression thing. And depression is like a cancer. It spreads into every single avenue of your life. There's no part of your life that will not be touched at all. It will touch every single element of your life, and there is not much you can do about it because it's there and it is awake and it is moving. And you're thinking, no, Mara, how? Stay tuned.
Care that helps you care for others. That's the Basic Mental Health First Aid course, free for NHP members. You'll learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So today's conversation is about how are we going to still get things done even though we are depressed? How are we still going to go to work? How are we still going to bath? How are we still going to take care of children? How are we still going to be productive members of society even though we've got this thing that's going on and this thing is bigger than us? This thing is yay. This thing, it comes in intervals. It's like heartbreak that hates nighttime. It comes in intervals. One, sikunawa, sikunay, namipefonda loloka. It is one moment we're up and one moment we're dying. One moment it's our mood that's fluctuating. It is thoughts. It's just not being well. And a friend of mine and I have this slogan of Nenamberinandirarapo. Like kushishina ngerino rapo ningo ararapo akutiwara Nenamberinandirarapo. Like mbeash ndatarambera neninandirarapo ningo nginyano ngeshashino kandi uvitotu wakantumbire wathikamene ende oshiri. It's like your body is over there and you are just out here and you are trying your absolute best, right? Mara, well, hey, kabetala anumbiro kavena ingonginyano. But we don't really give up just like that. And I'm thinking that maybe this is a conversation worth having. Maybe it's not only something that I feel, but it's something that is out there and something that you guys might be going through. I know many of us are going around undiagnosed and we're going around not really knowing what's up with us. And I encourage most, like, yeah, let's go guys, ooh, mental healthy, and let's go, and let's get ourselves checked out. And then when we get checked out, then we know, then we can regulate, but medication is half the step one, right? Medication and acceptance and knowledge is half the step one. But then there's that other 50% that comes with its own challenges. Part of that 50% is the fact that there's therapy that is needed, right? And then there is lifestyle changes. And then there is this whole thing of adapting. Adapting, understanding, and being in it. And that is a whole mountain on its own. Because the first couple of days, you feel good. Because now you know what it is. But you don't know what is coming for you. You don't know how it's going to come for you. You know it's coming. You know it's there. But it eats funny and it walks funny. Shimanande shino. Not at all.
Cyber threats are no longer just an IT problem. They are a risk to our national security and the core of our economy. Join various leaders and industry stakeholders at the 3rd Namibia International Cybersecurity Conference and Exhibition, NICSC 2026, taking place from the 22nd to the 24th of April at Arabush Travelodge in Windhoek. Corporate early bird registrations close on the 31st of March. So register now at dstech.com.na. NICSC 2026. securing Africa's digital future.
All right. So how are we going to do this? How are we going to still keep working, still keep living, still keep being parents? How are we going to continue this ball? How are we going to keep running with it? Even though, right, it is a storm on its own. And it is wild. So how to get stuff done when you're depressed? Ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of the clip that we're going to play now. It's going to be a 10-minute clip. And then we're going to go on to talk about what depression is and maybe, just maybe, why I think many of us are actually in the dungeons and the trenches.
You're not lazy. You're not broken. You're just carrying something really heavy, something no one else can see. And when your mind feels like it's moving through quicksand, even the smallest tasks can feel impossible. But you still deserve kindness, patience, and a way forward that doesn't punish you for struggling. Let's talk about how to be productive in a way that actually works when you're depressed, without guilt, without shame, and without pretending everything is fine. So keep things simple. You wake up, and before you even open your eyes, there's this weight pressing down on you. Not just exhaustion, the kind that makes even getting out of bed feel impossible. You stare at the ceiling, knowing you should get up, take a shower, eat something, reply to messages, but instead, you remain down. 'Cause where do you even start? Even just thinking about what you need to do can drain that little energy you have left. So, let's make it easier on yourself. Pick one tiny thing to do first. Focus on just that first step. Whether it's taking the covers off over your head, moving to the edge of the bed and putting your feet on the floor, stretching your toes and your fingers, or drinking a glass of water. That's a win. The bigger tasks can wait at this point. What you're feeling is real, and these little steps are a big deal. Let go of the all-or-nothing pressure. When you're depressed, you might feel like if you can't do it all, then it's not worth trying. And I get it. But here's the thing. Done is better than perfect. A half-cleaned room is still cleaner than before, and eating something, even if it's not a perfectly balanced meal, is still nourishing your body. A single-answered email is still progress. If you only make it to the couch instead of the gym, that's okay. You're doing what you can, and that's enough. And when even that feels too hard, remember, you don't have to do it all at once or do everything today. Give yourself compassion, or else. Depression makes even the smallest tasks feel overwhelming, and that's not your fault. Instead of beating yourself up for what you haven't done, acknowledge the effort it takes just to get through the day. Productivity isn't about perfection, it's about doing what you can when you can. Be kind to yourself, celebrate small wins, and remember that progress, no matter how slow, is still progress. Create a low-energy to-do list. When I battle depression, mornings feel like the hardest part of the day. It feels like there's a million things to do, but no energy to do any of it. Some days, I lie there hoping the world will slow down or that the day would somehow pass without me having to face it. And at first, I think every task on my list requires the same amount of energy, but I eventually remember that that's not true. What I find is that prioritizing and focusing on the small, low-energy tasks make everything feel a little bit more doable. For example, if you also struggle with cleaning, it's okay to pick up one dish and put it in the sink. That's it. No pressure to do more. Struggling to shower? Then focus on brushing my teeth or just washing my face. Do you have reports to write? Write one sentence. That's all. One sentence feels so much better than nothing. At the end of the day, it's not about doing everything. It's about doing something. And that's enough. But there's one extra thing that you can do to make starting feel a bit easier. Try the 5-minute rule. Your brain is more likely to agree to just 5 minutes than to commit to a whole task. And you know what? More often than not, once you start, you'll keep going. I know, 5 minutes might sound like nothing, but imagine this. You tell yourself you'll only wash one dish, but before you know it, you've done three. You start stretching, and suddenly, you're moving a little more. You begin writing, and before you know it, you've done more than you thought you could. And maybe you stop there. Or maybe you keep going. Either way, it's more than nothing. And that is a win. However, you don't have to go through this alone. Are you enjoying this video? Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell. Human and adapting. Just like you'd ask for help if you had a broken leg or physical illness, it's okay to ask for help when you're struggling mentally. If asking feels difficult, try a simple message. Hi, I'm struggling today. Could you help me with this? People who care about you want to help, so let them. Sometimes just knowing someone is expecting an update gives you that extra push to start. You can also join online communities or find an accountability partner to support each other. And just like you can lean on people, you can also use technology to lighten the burden. Use AI and technology to make things easier. You don't have to push through everything on your own. Let technology do some of the heavy lifting. Struggling to write emails or messages? ChatGPT can help you draft them when you don't have the mental energy. Just type, "Help me write an email, I'm struggling with deadlines." Feeling overwhelmed by tasks? Apps like To-Do List or Notion can organize things for you. Need motivation? Some apps make self-care feel a little easier by turning it into a game. Finch and Fabulous use gamification, meaning they add small rewards, streaks, and challenges to make habits feel less like chores and more like tiny wins. For example, Finch lets you grow a virtual pet by completing simple tasks like drinking water or taking deep breaths. Fabulous gives you daily challenges and progress streaks to help you stay on track. These little incentives can make starting tasks feel more rewarding, even when motivation is low. Keep forgetting things? Set reminders or alarms to take tasks off your mind. Depression is exhausting, so let tools handle what they can so you have more energy for what matters. Create a done list. When you're feeling really low, it's easy to get caught up in what you haven't done, especially when it feels like everything is piling up. Instead of focusing on the tasks you haven't completed, try shifting your attention to what you have. Creating a done list can help you do that. Instead of looking at the long list of things you still need to get done, jot down what you've already accomplished. It serves as a visual reminder that you're moving forward, even when it doesn't feel like it. You can use a notebook, a note on your phone, or even a digital app, whatever feels easiest. Make sure you keep it simple and specific. For example, instead of saying, "I worked on a report," write, "I opened my laptop and typed one line." Or instead of, "I got out of bed," write, "I sat up for 5 minutes." When a day feels particularly heavy, take a few moments to look back over your done list. It's a way to gently remind yourself that you're not stagnant. You're doing enough just by being here. Depression is an extremely difficult and draining experience. And it's okay to move at your own pace. Every tiny step you take is progress, and it's priceless. So please be gentle with yourself. Every day brings you closer to your healing. Now, I'd love to hear from you. What's one?
Shortly after I published my book, I got an email. It said, "Your book was the only thing that saved me from suicide. You saved my life." Now, my book is about how to clean, so that seems kind of weird, right? But what if a new philosophy on cleaning could teach us a better approach to mental health? I'm not an interior designer or a lifestyle influencer. I'm just a therapist with ADHD. And in February of 2020, I had my second baby. Because with the first one, I had some postpartum anxiety, and my husband had just taken a very demanding job that was going to keep him busy, I developed a meticulous postpartum plan for myself. My family would rotate in shifts for the first 60 days. The cleaning crew would come once a month. The new moms group would drop off dinners, and my toddler would go to preschool. I was so proud of this plan, and it ended before it even began. Because February of 2020 is when the COVID lockdowns happened, and all of that support disappeared overnight. In a blur, my days turned into breastfeeding difficulties, toddler meltdowns, and depression. The dishes stayed in the sink for days. The laundry pile reached impressive heights. And there was often not a path to walk from room to room. And when I should have been catching up on sleep, I would lay in bed at night and think to myself, I'm failing. Maybe I'm not capable of being a good mom to two kids. I decided to post a joke video on TikTok one day about my house turned disaster. Some funny shots of my clutter and my dishes and my enchilada pan to a nice beat. Sort of a laugh to keep from cry situation, surely. And I got a comment. Lazy. Yeah, that stung. But I must be a glutton for punishment because I kept posting videos about my messy house. Video after video of all of the weird tips and tricks that I was using to try and get it back in order while managing my feelings of being overwhelmed. And I braced myself for more criticism. But what happened was entirely different. In the comment sections of my videos, hundreds of stories came rolling in. Stories like Amanda, who after losing her baby in the second trimester was standing frozen at her sink because she forgot how to wash dishes. Stories like Lula, whose chronic health problems and depression made it difficult for her to brush her teeth. Story after story of people with depression, ADHD, autism, burnout, bereavement, all struggling with these daily tasks. And it might seem odd to some of you that someone could struggle with tasks that are so simple. But are they simple? Let's think about what really goes into something like laundry. Everyone picture your laundry pile right now, okay? How many clean clothes do you have left right now? Can you wash tomorrow or must it be today? Do you need to prioritize, pre-sort, pre-treat anything? Did you grow up with anybody that taught you how to do that? You're out of laundry detergent. If you work three jobs, when are you going to get to the store next? And if you get there, can you afford it? And if you can afford it, which one you choose? And you get it all home, get it in there. Now pick a setting. Which one? I don't know. Google it. By the way, you have memory problems. So you'll remember that wash in about 3 days when it's mildewed into the washer. It's okay. Just rewash it, okay, and get it into the dryer. You'll forget that too, and it'll wrinkle. Now dry it again. Now all you have to do is get it out and fold it. But also you have three small children, and those three small children haven't given you a moment alone in quite some time. But when you finally get that moment, you have to decide. Are you going to finish the laundry? Are you going to eat a sandwich? Are you going to take a nap? Time's up. You didn't do any of it. You stared at the wall. You have decision fatigue because the burden of carrying a home all by yourself has burnt you out. You see, for some of you, all of the steps and the skills that go into care tasks run on autopilot. But for millions of people, the autopilot is broken. And what's worse, what if you had to do all of that when your mom just died? Or your job just fired you? Or you're using every ounce of strength that you have to just not kill yourself today? If you have access to therapy, it's unlikely your therapist will ever ask you about your laundry. I've worked in mental health for about a decade. I've been in therapy even longer. And the only time I ever had a provider...
Titanium, the perfect fit between platinum and silver, complementing our existing benefit options. We always offer a comprehensive healthcare experience. NHP, the premier member-centric medical aid fund. Visit NHP today at nhp.com.na. NHP, we're about you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, as we proceed.
Ider talked to me about things like cooking and cleaning and brushing my teeth was when I was in a psych hospital as a teenager. Yet here were hundreds of thousands of people in my comment sections telling me that these daily care tasks were a major pain point in their life. And so I started to wonder, what if we started here? What if we started with these care tasks? Could making daily tasks easier improve mental health quicker? In the 2 years that I've been posting and writing about the intersection of mental health and care tasks, I've come up with a philosophy that does just this. And it all starts with one simple idea. Cooking, cleaning, laundry. It doesn't make you a good person or a bad person. Listen to me. Care tasks are morally neutral. Now, I know that if you've been watching Martha Stewart for decades and scrolling the perfect Pinterest aesthetic every day, that it can feel like struggling with these tasks is a moral failure. Like it's because we're lazy or we're irresponsible or we're immature. But having an organized closet doesn't make you a success. And living out of a pile of laundry on the floor doesn't make you a failure. You know where the shirt you want to wear is. It might take you a bit of sifting to find it. The truth is, it's not about morality. It's about functionality. Does your home work for you? Not some hypothetical house guest that is coming to inspect your closet. I mentioned Amanda, who had lost her baby and forgot how to wash dishes. She told me that when her husband would go to work, she would lay on the floor next to the empty crib and say to herself, "What can I bring to my family if I can't even wash dishes?" But that changed when she began to see care tasks as morally neutral. All of a sudden, the dishes in the sink weren't representations of her failure as a wife. But instead, she would look at the pile and think to herself, "What do I need to function tomorrow morning?" And then pull 2 coffee cups out of the pile to wash. She had her coffee the next morning, and it was a little bit easier to get up off the floor. When we liberate ourselves from the idea that we are a good person or a bad person with care tasks, we can stop thinking about the right way to do things, about the way that things should be done, and instead start thinking about what we can do with our current barriers to improve our quality of life today. And this is the fun part, because you get to customize a life that works for you. When Lula realized that her problems with brushing her teeth were not moral failings, she gained the confidence to speak to her dental hygienist. And together, they came up with solutions that work around her barriers. She now relies on pre-pasted disposable toothbrushes that she keeps in her desk, floss she keeps in the living room, and a no-rinse prescription toothpaste. Because by breaking down the component parts of a dental hygiene routine and ensuring that each step was accessible to her mental and physical needs, for the first time in a year, she's done every step in that routine for 2 weeks straight. She says that now that her teeth are clean, she's a little less stressed about tomorrow's problems. And this approach can work with any care task that you struggle with. Simply ask yourself, what am I trying to achieve and how can I achieve it in my way? In a rare moment of folding clothes, I looked down at the baby onesie that I was folding, and I thought to myself, why am I folding this? Baby onesies don't really wrinkle. And even if they did, nobody cares if a baby's in a wrinkly onesie. Furthermore, I was probably going to change her 4 times before lunch. This doesn't need to be folded. I said it out loud and literally braced myself for the laundry police. I don't know. There are rules to laundry. But for the first time, I stopped thinking about the way that laundry should be done and instead started thinking about how I could make laundry functional for me. And I looked down at the fleece pajamas and the underwear and the athletic shorts and the tank tops and realized almost none of my clothes actually needed to be folded. And I haven't folded any of it since. I moved all of my family's clothes into one closet off the laundry room, and now I just toss things into organized bins unfolded. My new motto is good enough is perfect. And everything worth doing is worth doing half-assed. You have to give yourself permission to do a little, to do it with shortcuts, to do it while breaking all of the rules, and replace that inner voice that says, I'm failing, with one that says, I'm having a hard time right now. And people who are having a hard time deserve compassion. If it's too hard to shower today, grab the baby wipes. It may not be the normal way to do it, but you deserve to be clean. If it's too hard to cook dinner, get paper plates. Heat up something frozen. You'll go back to cooking and washing another day, but the day is not today. And in the meantime, you deserve to eat. If you're too depressed to do your dishes, get a 2-gallon Ziploc bag and keep it in your bedroom. Because if you put a dirty plate into a 2-gallon Ziploc bag and seal it, it will keep the bugs away. And it'll be there for you when you're ready to go back to the kitchen. Because you deserve a sanitary environment, even if you can't get out of bed. I could share with you hundreds of other genius solutions that people have come up with once they embrace the idea that care tasks are morally neutral. In my experience, people will exhibit mind-blowing creativity when they are only taught how to speak compassionately to themselves. So what if mental health treatment started here? By shifting the idea of care tasks as these external measurements of your worthiness to just being morally neutral tasks that you can customize to care for yourself. Because if it's true that regardless of what you struggle with, you are worthy of a functional space, what else might you be worthy of? Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. So how are we going to break through this? We're going to do it in intervals. We're going to do... I think the biggest problem that we have is that we assume that things have to be done absolutely perfectly. As if we are running on, we are running on the same energy that we've been running on. As if there are no life-changing things that have happened. As if you must just box that and put that in a compartment and then, you know, just ignore it and go through it and you're going to be fine. As if that is how we do it. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that, especially when you're dealing with something as major as depression. So the first thing we're going to do is break up tasks. We're going to break up the things that we need to do per day. So, my dear, you need to go to work, but you can't smell. You need to get to work, but you can't sleep all day. You have to go to work, but you can't drink all day, all night. So, put the bottle down. And maybe just move the things a little bit. And then that's a win. We are not saying clean up the whole entire house. We're saying just move the things from the bed to the ground. And then tomorrow we move the things from the bed. And we'll see where it divides. Divide large projects into small, manageable steps to avoid feeling overwhelmed. Because if you give yourself a task... If you give yourself a 5-hour task, the likelihood of you doing absolutely nothing is very, very high. Have you ever been in a space where you completely zone out and you have so many things to do, but you just can't do them. Or you just can't do them right now because you're thinking about doing them. Or you're thinking about when to do them. Or you're thinking about how to do them so that it is a success. And then when you go and look at yourself, time has gone. And this also happens a lot with our social media, where you apparently went onto social media to unwind. But the truth is that you are just escaping everything that you need to do, like cooking and cleaning and washing and getting things ready and getting yourself ready, taking a bath, taking care of yourself. You're just avoiding all of that. And then you just dive into the world of social media, the gadget. By the time you look up, it has been 6 hours. And it's almost time to go to work, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and the kids are getting up for school, and you have to drop them off. And now you only have 1 hour of sleep because you have to be at work at 8 o'clock, and then you have to finish dropping off the kids in 30 minutes. And sometimes those 30 minutes don't work. And then by the time you come back, you can't sleep because you have to get ready. You're taking things from the ground and then you're wearing them, and that's it. Now, many of us don't notice our dysfunctional or our disorganized home lives because we have help, right? We have the nanny. And the nanny usually keeps your house together while you fall apart in peace. While the kids, the family, they watch you fall apart, but at least the house is not falling apart. And that is one of your biggest concerns. So you give those tasks to someone else. And that's not bad. It's not bad at all. But just notice it. Notice that this is what you're doing. Because I know I'm doing it. I know straight up I'm doing it. So maybe depression is the secret we care. We all share.
I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading till I felt that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating till I felt my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as if the heavens were a bell, and being were an ear, and I and silence, some strange race, wrecked, solitary here. Just then, a plank in reason broke, and I fell down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. We know depression through metaphors. Emily Dickinson was able to convey it in language, Goya in an image. Half the purpose of art is to describe such iconic states. As for me, I had always thought myself tough, one of the people who could survive if I'd been sent to a concentration camp. In 1991, I had a series of losses. My mother died, a relationship I'd been in ended, I moved back to the United States from some years abroad, and I got through all of those experiences intact. But in 1994, 3 years later, I found myself losing interest in almost everything. I didn't want to do any of the things I had previously wanted to do, and I didn't know why. The opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And it was vitality that seemed to seep away from me. In that moment, everything there was to do seemed like too much work. I would come home and I would see the red light flashing on my answering machine. And instead of being thrilled to hear from my friends, I would think, what a lot of people that is to have to call back. Or I would decide I should have lunch. And then I would think, but I'd have to get the food out and put it on a plate and cut it up and chew it and swallow it. And it felt to me like the stations of the cross. And one of the things that often gets lost in discussions of depression is that you know it's ridiculous. You know it's ridiculous while you're experiencing it. You know that most people manage to listen to their messages and eat lunch and organize themselves to take a shower and go out the front door, and that it's not a big deal. And yet, you are nonetheless in its grip, and you are unable to figure out any way around it. And so I began to feel myself doing less and thinking less and feeling less. It was a kind of nullity. And then the anxiety set in. If you told me that I have to be depressed for the next month, I would say, as long as I know it'll be over in November, I can do it. But if you said to me, you have to have acute anxiety for the next month, I would rather slit my wrist than go through it. It was the feeling all the time, like that feeling you have if you're walking and you slip or trip and the ground is rushing up at you, but instead of lasting half a second the way that does, it lasted for 6 months. It's a sensation of being afraid all the time, but not even knowing what it is that you're afraid of. And it was at that point that I began to think that it was just too painful to be alive, and that the only reason not to kill oneself was so as not to hurt other people. And finally, one day, I woke up, and I thought perhaps I'd had a stroke, because I lay in bed completely frozen, looking at the telephone, thinking, something is wrong, and I should call for help. And I couldn't reach out my arm and pick up the phone and dial. And finally, after 4 full hours of my lying and staring at it, the phone rang, and somehow I managed to pick it up. And it was my father. And I said, I'm in serious trouble. We need to do something. The next day, I started with the medications and the therapy. And I also started reckoning with this terrible question. If I'm not the tough person who could have made it through a concentration camp, then who am I? And if I have to take medication, is that medication making me more fully myself? Or is it making me someone else? And how do I feel about it if it's making me someone else? I had 2 advantages as I went into the fight. The first is that I knew that, objectively speaking, I had a nice life, and that if I could only get well, there was something at the other end that was worth living for. And the other was that I had access to good treatment. But I nonetheless emerged and relapsed, and emerged and relapsed, and emerged and relapsed, and finally understood I would have to be on medication and in therapy forever. And I thought, but is it a chemical problem or a psychological problem? And does it need a chemical cure or a philosophical cure? And I couldn't figure out which it was. And then I understood that actually we aren't advanced enough in either area for it to explain things fully. The chemical cure and the psychological cure both have a role to play. And I also figured out that depression was something that was braided so deep into us that there was no separating it from our character and personality. I want to say that the treatments we have for depression are appalling. They're not very effective. They're extremely costly. They come with innumerable side effects. They're a disaster. But I am so grateful that I live now and not 50 years ago, when there would have been almost nothing to be done. I hope that 50 years hence, people will hear about my treatments and be appalled that anyone endured such primitive science. Depression is the flaw in love. If you were married to someone and thought, well, if my wife dies, I'll find another one, it wouldn't be love as we know it. There's no such thing as love without the anticipation of loss. And that specter of despair can be the engine of intimacy. There are 3 things people tend to confuse: depression, grief, and sadness. Grief is explicitly reactive. If you have a loss and you feel incredibly unhappy, and then 6 months later you're still deeply sad but you're functioning a little better, it's probably grief, and it will probably ultimately resolve itself in some measure. If you experience a catastrophic loss and you feel terrible, and 6 months later you can barely function at all, then it's probably a depression that was triggered by the catastrophic circumstances. The trajectory tells us a great deal. People think of depression as being just sadness. It's much, much too much sadness, much too much grief, at far too slight a cause. As I set out to understand depression and to interview people who had experienced it, I found that there were people who seemed on the surface to have what sounded like relatively mild depression, who were nonetheless utterly disabled by it. And there were other people who had what sounded, as they described it, like terribly severe depression, who nonetheless had good lives in the interstices between their depressive episodes. And I set out to find out what it is that causes some people to be more resilient than other people. What are the mechanisms that allow people to survive? And I went out and I interviewed person after person who was suffering with depression. One of the first people I interviewed described depression as a slower way of being dead. And that was a good thing for me to hear early on, because it reminded me that that slow way of being dead can lead to actual deadness, that this is a serious business. It's the leading disability worldwide, and people die of it every day. One of the people I talked to when I was trying to understand this was a beloved friend who I had known for many years and who had had a psychotic episode in her freshman year of college and then plummeted into a horrific depression. She had bipolar illness, or manic depression as it was then known. And then she did very well for many years on lithium. And then eventually she was taken off her lithium to see how she would do without it. And she had another psychosis, and then plunged into the worst depression that I had ever seen, in which she sat in her parents' apartment, more or less catatonic, essentially without moving, day after day after day. And when I interviewed her about that experience some years later — she's a poet and psychotherapist named Maggie Robbins — when I interviewed her, she said, "I was singing, 'Where have all the flowers gone?' over and over to occupy my mind. I was singing to blot out the things my mind was saying, which were, you are nothing. You are nobody. You don't even deserve to live." And that was when I really started thinking about killing myself. You don't think in depression that you've put on a gray veil and are seeing the world through the haze of a bad mood. You think that the veil has been taken away, the veil of happiness, and that now you're seeing truly. It's easier to help schizophrenics who perceive that there's something foreign inside of them that needs to be exercised, but it's difficult with depressives because we believe we are seeing the truth. But the truth lies. I became obsessed with that sentence, "but the truth lies." And I discovered as I talked to depressive people that they have many delusional perceptions. People will say, "No one loves me." And you say, "I love you. Your wife loves you. Your mother loves you." You can answer that one pretty readily, at least for most people. But people who are depressed will also say, "No matter what we do, we're all just going to die in the end." Or they'll say, "There can be no true communion between two human beings. Each of us is trapped in his own body." To which you have to say, "That's true, but I think we should focus right now on what to have for breakfast." A lot of the time, what they are expressing is not illness, but insight. And one comes to think what's really extraordinary is that most of us know about those existential questions, and they don't distract us very much. There was a study I particularly liked in which a group of depressed and a group of non-depressed people were asked to play a video game for an hour. And at the end of the hour, they were asked how many little monsters they thought they had killed. The depressive group was usually accurate to within about 10%. And the non-depressed people guessed between 15 and 20 times as many little monsters as they had actually killed. A lot of people said when I chose to write about my depression that it must be very difficult to be out of that closet, to have people know. They said, "Do people talk to you differently?" And I said, "Yes, people talk to me differently. They talk to me differently insofar as they start telling me about their experience or their sister's experience or their friend's experience. Things are different because now I know that depression is the family secret that everyone has." I went a few years ago to a conference. And on Friday of the three-day conference, one of the participants took me aside and she said, I suffer from depression and I'm a little embarrassed about it, but I've been taking this medication and I just wanted to ask you what you think. And so I did my best to give her such advice as I could. And then she said, you know, my husband would never understand this. He's really the kind of guy to whom this wouldn't make any sense. So I just, you know, it's just between us. And I said, yes, that's fine. On Sunday at the same conference, her husband took me aside. And he said, my wife wouldn't think that I was really much of a guy if she knew this, but I've been dealing with this depression and I'm taking some medication and I wondered what you think. They were hiding the same medication in two different places in the same bedroom. And I said that I thought communication within the marriage might be triggering some of their problems. But I was also struck by the burdensome nature of such mutual secrecy. Depression is so exhausting. It takes up so much of your time and energy, and silence about it, it really does make the depression worse. And then I began thinking about all the ways people make themselves better. I'd started off as a medical conservative. I thought there were a few kinds of therapy that worked. It was clear what they were. There was medication, there were certain psychotherapies, there was possibly electroconvulsive treatment, and that everything else was nonsense. But then I discovered something. If you have brain cancer, and you say that standing on your head for 20 minutes every morning makes you feel better, it may make you feel better, but you still have brain cancer, and you'll still probably die from it. But if you say that you have depression, and standing on your head for 20 minutes every day makes you feel better, then it's worked, because depression is an illness of how you feel. And if you feel better, then you're effectively not depressed anymore. So I became much more tolerant of the vast world of alternative treatments. And I get letters. I get hundreds of letters from people writing to tell me about what's worked for them. Someone was asking me backstage today about meditation. My favorite of the letters that I got was the one that came from a woman who wrote and said that she had tried therapy, she had tried medication, she had tried pretty much everything, and she had found a solution and hoped I would tell the world. And that was making little things from yarn. She sent me some of them, and I'm not wearing them right now. I suggested to her that she also should look up obsessive-compulsive disorder in the DSM. And yet, when I went to look at alternative treatments, I also gained perspective on other treatments. I went through a tribal exorcism in Senegal that involved a great deal of ram's blood and that I'm not going to detail right now. But a few years afterwards, I was in Rwanda working on a different project, and I happened to describe my experience to someone. And he said, well, you know, that's West Africa, and we're in East Africa, and our rituals are in some ways very different, but we do have some rituals that have something in common with what you're describing. And I said, oh, and he said, yes. He said, but we've had a lot of trouble with Western mental health workers, especially the ones who came right after the genocide. And I said, what kind of trouble did you have? And he said, well, he said they would do this bizarre thing. He said they didn't take people out in the sunshine where you begin to feel better. They didn't include drumming or music to get people's blood going. They didn't involve the whole community. They didn't externalize the depression as an invasive spirit. Instead, what they did was they took people one at a time into dingy little rooms and had them talk for an hour about bad things that had happened to them. He said, we had to ask them to leave the country. Now, at the other end of alternative treatments, let me tell you about Frank Rusakoff. Frank Rusakoff had the worst depression, perhaps, that I've ever seen in a man. He was constantly depressed. He was, when I met him, at a point at which every month he would have electroshock treatment. Then he would feel sort of disoriented for a week. Then he would feel okay for a week. Then he would have a week of going downhill. And then he would have another electroshock treatment. And he said to me when I met him, it's unbearable to go through my weeks this way. I can't go on this way.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
And I figured out how I'm going to end it if I don't get better. But he said to me, I heard about a protocol at Mass General for a procedure called a cingulotomy, which is a brain surgery, and I think I'm going to give that a try. And I remember being amazed at that point to think that someone who clearly had so many bad experiences with so many different treatments still had buried in him somewhere enough optimism to reach out for one more. And he had the cingulotomy, and it was incredibly successful. He's now a friend of mine. He has a lovely wife and 2 beautiful children. He wrote me a letter the Christmas after the surgery, and he said, my father sent me 2 presents this year. First, a motorized CD rack from the Sharper Image that I didn't really need, but I knew he was giving it to me to celebrate the fact that I'm living on my own and have a job I seem to love. And the other present was a photo of my grandmother, who committed suicide. As I unwrapped it, I began to cry, and my mother came over and said, are you crying because of the relatives you never knew? And I said, she had the same disease I have. I'm crying now as I write to you. It's not that I'm so sad, but I get overwhelmed. I think because I could have killed myself, but my parents kept me going, and so did the doctors, and I had the surgery. I'm alive and grateful. We live in the right time, even if it doesn't always feel like it. I was struck by the fact that depression is broadly perceived to be a modern Western middle class thing, and I went to look at how it operated in a variety of other contexts. And one of the things I was most interested in was depression among the indigent. And so I went out to try to look at what was being done for poor people with depression. And what I discovered is that poor people are mostly not being treated for depression. Depression is the result of a genetic vulnerability, which is presumably evenly distributed in the population, and triggering circumstances, which are likely to be more severe for people who are impoverished. And yet, it turns out that if you have a really lovely life but feel miserable all the time, you think, why do I feel like this? I must have depression. And you set out to find treatment for it. But if you have a perfectly awful life and you feel miserable all the time, the way you feel is commensurate with your life.
Guys, a perfectly awful life and you feel miserable all the time. Yeah, well, you know.
It doesn't occur to you to think maybe this is treatable. And so we have an epidemic in this country of depression among impoverished people that's not being picked up and that's not being treated and that's not being addressed. And it's a tragedy of a grand order. And so I found an academic who was doing a research project in slums outside of D.C., where she picked up women who had come in for other health problems and diagnosed them with depression and then provided 6 months of them. One of them, Lolly, came in, and this is what she said the day she came in. She said, and she was a woman, by the way, who had 7 children. She said, I used to have a job, but I had to give it up because I couldn't go out of the house. I have nothing to say to my children. In the morning, I can't wait for them to leave, and then I climb in bed and pull the covers over my head. And 3 o'clock when they come home, it just comes so fast. She said, I've been taking a lot of Tylenol, anything I can take so that I can sleep more. My husband has been telling me I'm stupid, I'm ugly. I wish I could stop the pain. Well, she was brought into this experimental protocol, and when I interviewed her 6 months later, she had taken a job working in childcare for the U.S. Navy. She had left the abusive husband, and she said to me, my kids are so much happier now. She said, there's one room in my new place for the boys and one room for the girls, but at night, they're just all up on my bed, and we're doing homework all together and everything. One of them wants to be a preacher, one of them wants to be a firefighter, and one of the girls says she's going to be a lawyer. They don't cry like they used to, and they don't fight like they did. That's all I need now, is my kids. Things keep on changing. The way I dress, the way I feel, the way I act. I can go outside not being afraid anymore. And I don't think those bad feelings are coming back. And if it weren't for Dr. Miranda and that, I would still be at home with the covers pulled over my head, if I were still alive at all. I asked the Lord to send me an angel, and he heard my prayers. I was really moved by these experiences, and I decided that I wanted to write about them, not only in a book I was working on, but also in an article. And so I got a commission from the New York Times Magazine to write about depression among the indigent. And I turned in my story, and my editor called me and said, "We really can't publish this." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "It just is too far-fetched. These people who are sort of at the very bottom rung of society, and then they get a few months of treatment, and they're virtually ready to run Morgan Stanley. It's just too implausible." She said, "I've never even heard of anything like it." And I said, "The fact that you've never heard of it is an indication that it is news." "And you are a news magazine." So after a certain amount of negotiation, they agreed to it. But I think a lot of what they said was connected in some strange way to this distaste that people still have for the idea of treatment, the notion that somehow if we went out and treated a lot of people in indigent communities, that would be an exploitative thing to do because we would be changing them. There's this false moral imperative that seems to be all around us that treatment of depression, the medications and so on, are an artifice and that it's not natural. And I think that's very misguided. It would be natural for people's teeth to fall out, but there is nobody militating against toothpaste, at least not in my circles. And people then say, "Well, but isn't depression part of what people are supposed to experience? Didn't we evolve to have depression? Isn't it part of your personality?" To which I would say, mood is adaptive. Being able to have sadness and fear and joy and pleasure and all of the other moods that we have, that's incredibly valuable. And major depression is something that happens when that system gets broken. It's maladaptive. People will come to me and say, "I think, though, if I just stick it out for another year, I think I can just get through this." And I always say to them, "You may get through it, but you'll never be 37 again. Life is short. And that's a whole year you're talking about giving up. Think it through." It's a strange poverty of the English language, and indeed of many other languages, that we use the same word, depression, to describe how a kid feels when it rains on his birthday, and to describe how somebody feels the minute before they commit suicide. People say to me, "Well, is it continuous with normal sadness?" And I say, in a way, it's continuous with normal sadness. There is a certain amount of continuity, but it's the same way there's continuity between having an iron fence outside your house that gets a little rust spot that you have to sort of sand off and maybe do a little repainting, and what happens if you leave the house for 100 years and it rusts through until it's only a pile of orange dust. And it's that orange dust spot, that orange dust problem, that's the one we're setting out to address. So now people say, "You take these happy pills and do you feel happy?" And I don't. But I don't feel sad about having to eat lunch. And I don't feel sad about my answering machine. And I don't feel sad about taking a shower. I feel more, in fact, I think, because I can feel sadness without nullity. I feel sad about professional disappointments, about damaged relationships, about global warming. Those are the things that I feel sad about now. And I said to myself, "Well, what is the conclusion? How did those people who have better lives, even with bigger depression, manage to get through? What is the mechanism of resilience?" And what I came up with over time was that the people who deny their experience, the ones who say, "I was depressed a long time ago, and I never want to think about it again, and I'm not going to look at it, and I'm just going to get on with my life," ironically, those are the people who are most enslaved by what they have. Shutting out the depression strengthens it. While you hide from it, it grows. And the people who do better are the ones who are able to tolerate the fact that they have this condition, Those who can tolerate their depression are the ones who achieve resilience. So Frank Rusakoff said to me, if I had it to do over, I suppose I wouldn't do it this way. But in a strange way, I'm grateful for what I've experienced. I'm glad to have been in the hospital 40 times. It taught me so much about love, and my relationship with my parents and my doctors has been so precious to me and will be always. And Maggie Robbins said, I used to volunteer in an AIDS clinic, and I would just talk and talk and talk. And the people I was dealing with weren't very responsive, and I thought, that's not very friendly or helpful of them. And then I realized that they weren't going to do more than make those first few minutes of small talk. It was simply going to be an occasion where I didn't have AIDS and I wasn't dying, but could tolerate the fact that they did, and they were. Our needs are our greatest assets. It turns out I've learned to give all the things I need. Valuing one's depression does not prevent a relapse, but it may make the prospect of relapse, and even relapse itself, easier to tolerate. The question is not so much of finding great meaning and deciding your depression has been very meaningful, it's of seeking that meaning and thinking when it comes again, this will be hellish, but I will learn something from it. I had learned in my own depression how big an emotion can be, how it can be more real than facts. And I have found that that experience has allowed me to experience positive emotion in a more intense and more focused way. The opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And these days, my life is vital, even on the days when I'm sad. I felt that funeral in my brain, and I sat next to the colossus at the edge of the world. And I have discovered something inside of myself that I would have to call a soul that I had never formulated until that day 20 years ago when hell came to pay me a surprise visit. I think that while I hated being depressed and would hate to be depressed again, I found a way to love my depression. I love it because it has forced me to find and cling to joy. I love it because each day I decide, sometimes gamely and sometimes against the moment's reason, to cleave to the reasons for living. And that, I think, is a highly privileged rapture. Thank you.
Best speech ever. Now we are so motivated we can go outside and we can go and paint and we can go and do anything because hey. This one, it touched my soul. It touched my soul. And that was Andrew. And that was Andrew Solomon with Depression, the secret we share. So imagine a whole entire community, right? That is just so hell-bent on keeping this secret. And I totally and absolutely understand it. So ladies and gentlemen, how are we going to manage? How are we going to still be going to work? How are we going to still be parents? How are we still going to go through life? Even though, right? Even though it's very, very hard. Set realistic goals. If the goal is to just wake up and sit up in bed, then do that. I think that many of us are so frightened because the world keeps moving. The world keeps moving even if you're feeling all kinds of ways. The world keeps moving even if you're down and under. The number in studio is 083-288-401 if you would like to call in and talk about it. But the world keeps moving, ladies and gentlemen. It keeps moving and it keeps moving and it keeps moving. And I think that that is part of our biggest fears because it doesn't really give us breathing room. It doesn't give us space. Of course, yes, you can take 2 days off, 3 days off, but it has to continue. The show must go on. And you have to be a part of the show because everything else around you crumbled if you're not part of the show, and you have to keep pushing. So we are trying to find realistic ways in coping. So we are setting realistic goals, small goals. Like today, I just want to smile. Today I want to do one genuine laugh. Today I want to wake up. Today I just want to, I want to try my best, you know? Like, today I just want to try my best. And the third one is establish routines, like get up, 8:30, leave the house, and do this. Set an alarm, set as many alarms as you need to set. I've got so many alarms on my phone, and I was asked the other day, why do you have so many alarms? Where are you going? I'm like, these are alarms to remind me that I'm alive. These are alarms to remind me that I'm here. These are alarms to remind me that the battle is not over and we're still fighting and we're still part of it. These are alarms to keep me in the race, even when my mind goes astray. These are alarms that are going to one day save me from myself. These are alarms that I put up as reminders. Hey, matriarch, you still got it. Hey, matriarch, you are worthy. Hey, matriarch, eat something. Hey, matriarch, drink something. Hey, matriarch, keep going. Hey, matriarch, they love you. Hey, matriarch, just keep doing it. So I have a gang of reminders. And for me, those are routines. And also what I do during the day. I try and prioritize self-care. Self-care doesn't necessarily mean that you have to take those showers and you have to do that and you have to do that. Sometimes self-care means a baby wipe, chummy. It means just wiping your neck. It means that today was a win. That's it. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be mind-blowing. Just has to be a little bit of doneness. That's it.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the only person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
It's an incredible pleasure to be back here speaking at FAN. I'm sure I'm not the first speaker to make the little aperçu that I'm one of FAN's greatest fans, but I am. And I'm a huge fan of Lonnie Stonich and of all of the people who run this organization. I actually think that if Lonnie were put in charge of our response to Syria, that the whole situation could be sorted out in about 6 weeks. I'd encourage the president to bear it in mind. And I only wish there were a fan in every city, because this is such an extraordinary program. It's such an honor to be part of it. And people actually turn out for it, which is really, really phenomenal and very moving. The program has the Emily Dickinson poem from which the title of the talk is drawn. That's a poem about buoyancy and optimism. But I'm going to tell you another one of her poems. Emily Dickinson is our theme tonight. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till I felt that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as if the heavens were a bell and being were an ear, and I and silence some strange race wrecked solitary here. Just then, a plank in reason broke, and I fell down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then. It's difficult to find the language to describe depression, and that difficulty in finding such language is part of what isolates the people who are experiencing it. We need art and we need metaphor of the kind that Emily Dickinson employs in order to get some sense of how encompassing it is, the sense of those boots of lead, of the drumming of it, and of that feeling of falling down and down and down, sometimes in the literal plummet toward a suicide, but often just in the caving to the agony of emotions that one hadn't known were possible, that are excruciating in their every instant. In 1991, I had a number of difficulties in my life. My mother died, a relationship I thought might be forever came to an end, and I moved back to the United States from England, where I'd been living for a long time, and felt I had to start my life all over again. If they're making me into someone else, how do I feel about being someone else instead of the person I was used to being? Now, I had several advantages as I started on this. The first was that I knew intellectually that I had a pretty good life, and I knew that if I could only get better, it was a life that was worth living for. And the second was that I had access to excellent treatment, and excellent treatment makes an enormous difference. And of course, I had the support of my father and of various friends. I nonetheless, when I began to get better, felt as though I wanted to get away from that treatment and get back out of my father's house. And so I went through the pattern that will be familiar to many people in this room who've dealt with this particular challenge. I got better, and I thought I don't need all this treatment anymore. And I went off it all, and I relapsed. And then I went back on it, and I got better, and I thought I was okay. And I went off of it, and I relapsed. And I got better, and I relapsed, and I got better, and I relapsed. And it took me a decade to realize that this was not a fruitful game, and that I needed some kind of treatment, and I needed it to be sustained if I was actually going to build the kind of life I had always imagined I would have. There's often that question that people ask about whether depression is a chemical event or whether it's a psychological event. People say, but is it biological? Did it happen because of a chemical imbalance? And I believe very strongly that those are two different vocabularies for a single set of problems. I believe that everything can be described chemically, that someday we'll be able, when we have better scanning devices, to find where a college education resides in someone's brain and how their brain looks different once they've had one. And I believe, by the same token, that when the chemistry in your brain shifts, your experience in the world alters with it. And the idea of having to choose between those two ways of thinking seems to me to be lunatic. Understanding the brain should never preclude understanding the mind, or vice versa. The treatments we have for depression are frankly appalling. They take a long time to work. They're very expensive. They carry a lot of side effects. They don't work for everyone. They're a disaster. And yet, at the same time, I'm so grateful to live now and not 50 years ago and to have access to those treatments. I hope that in 50 years, people will look back on my experience and say, how could he endure those barbaric interventions? But I know how lucky I am to be living now and not to be living then. Now, what is depression itself? I opened my book about depression with the sentence, depression is the flaw in love. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what depression is. Is it adaptive? Is it counter-adaptive? Where does it come from? Why do we have it? The fact that we have a mood spectrum is unbelievably useful. Our capacity to be angry to be sad, to be joyful, to be frustrated, to have all of those different emotional experiences. That's part of what allows us to function in the human world. And we couldn't function without all of those moods. If you have something as delicate and complicated as that mood spectrum, the chance that it will go seriously wrong some of the time is enormous. But I also think that depression is an extreme manifestation of a kind of essential despair. And when I speak of it as the flaw in love, what I mean, in fact, is that love actually must entail the possibility of catastrophic loss. If you were happily married and thought, well, if my wife dies, I'll meet someone else, it'll be fine, that wouldn't be love as we know it. Love as we know it involves always fearing that loss. The love for our children involves worrying all the time about what might happen to them. And it's knowing that there's that possibility of complete collapse that gives some of the sweetness, the energy, the dynamism to love itself. It's what gives it its perilous, fragile beauty. And depression, while it represents a gross misfiring of this useful mood spectrum, is in some ways the ultimate expression of the vulnerabilities that in that regard help us to be fully human. People often ask me about the difference between depression and grief. And people asked me, because my depression followed the loss of my mother, whether it was just grief. Grief is a response that comes immediately after something terrible happens. If you are terribly pained by an event, and 6 months later you still feel sad, but a little less sad, and you can do a little more, it's probably grief, and you're slowly emerging from it. Grief's trajectory is towards some degree of resolution. If you have a terrible loss and you feel terrible, and 6 months later you're even more paralyzed, and 6 months after that you can't get up out of your bed, then you have a depression that was triggered by a loss, because the trajectory of depression is that it tends to get worse and worse until it finally begins, because it's a cyclical condition, to get better and better. As I began investigating the nature of depression outside my own experience and interviewing hundreds of people who had dealt with this condition, I was very struck by a curious inconsistency, it seemed to me, that there were some people who had what sounded, as they described it, like relatively minor depression, who were nonetheless completely disabled by it. And there were other people who had what sounded, as they described it, like really catastrophic depression, who nonetheless managed to have lives of some worth and value, at least in the interstices between their depressive episodes. And I began to wonder what the relationship was between illness and personality. How could it be that some people had these experiences and were able to do so much better than others in the face of them? Was that part of the illness, or was that something else in them? And what were the mechanisms of that resilience? And that became my guiding question as I investigated this. I had to look at the question of how serious this condition is. For a long time, people trivialized depression. It was shameful. It's quite boring. People felt that there was no point dwelling on it. But what I discovered as I began my investigation is how frequent it is. People say, oh, you talk openly about your depression. What do people say to you? Aren't you ashamed? And sometimes I am, especially when I'm actually depressed. But what I found is that what people mostly say to me is, I wanted to tell you about my sister, or I've been worried about this for ages, or I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through without killing myself. It's what people say over and over and over again. The ubiquity of depression can be totally overwhelming. I'm going to describe a few of the people I interviewed as I worked on the Noonday Demon and how they described their depression. Give them a sense of how... a sense of how other people have described depression, of what they were thinking, of what they said, of how they described that process. Laura Anderson is one of the people I interviewed. I had written an article in The New Yorker about my own experience of depression, and in the period after it was published, I received a huge number of letters from people writing in to tell me about their experiences And Laura was one of them, and we began a correspondence which has continued ever since. In fact, I had an email from her this afternoon. As we were corresponding, she began to settle into another round of depression. She wrote to me, "I am not yet in a full-blown depression, but I'm slowing down a little. I mean that I have to focus on each thing I do on more and more levels. I'm not completely depressed at this point, but I have entered a recession." And then a few weeks later, "I only take baths now because the water beating down on me from the shower is too much to deal with in the morning and seems these days like a violent way to begin the day. Driving seems like such an effort. So does visiting the ATM, shopping, you name it." And then, "The whole day thus far has been an excuse, an exercise in forcing myself to do the tiniest things and trying to evaluate how serious my situation is. Am I really depressed? Am I just lazy? Is this anxiety from too much coffee or from too much antidepressant? The self-assessment process itself made me start to weep." And then I looked at old photos today, and they seem like they are snapshots of someone else's life. Finally, she wrote to me about going to the botanical garden with her boyfriend. And she wrote, "By the description of one tree, it said, 'All parts deadly poisonous. I thought maybe I could find the tree, chew on a leaf or two, and curl up under a rock ledge and drift off. I miss the Laura who would have loved to put on her bathing suit and lie in the sun today and look at the blue, blue sky. Depression takes away whatever I really, really like about myself, which is not so much in the first place. Feeling hopeless and full of despair is just a slower way of being dead. This is my life now. This will always be my life, these terrible plummeting descents into hell. Can I stand to live this way?" I'll tell you about someone else I knew, one of my closest friends who I've known since I was 15. We were in college together when I was older than 15, and she had her first really serious breakdown during my freshman year. She had bipolar illness, and she developed an acute psychosis, a form of mania, and then she settled into depression. Her name is Maggie Robbins. She's since written a book about those experiences. It's a novel in verse called Susie Zeus Gets Organized, and I recommend it to all of you. But I remember talking to Maggie about those experiences, and I had no understanding of them then. And when people say, "Nobody understands my depression," I think how I didn't understand other people's depression for such a long time. Maggie did reasonably well. She was on lithium, and after she'd been doing well for more than 10 years, her very incompetent psychiatrist said, "You've done well for so long, why don't you try going off your medication?" Bipolar illness is a lifetime condition. You don't recover from it. And Maggie went off her medication, and she escalated into a terrifying psychosis and then sank into the worst depression I've ever seen. And I remember going up to see her when she was in it, when she was sitting in an apartment all by herself, totally catatonic, unable to move, unable to do anything. Later on in describing it, she said, "I would lie in bed singing, 'Where have all the flowers gone?' over and over to occupy my mind. I realize now that I could have had some other drugs or that I could have asked someone to come and sleep in my room, but I was just too sick to think of that. I couldn't say what scared me so much, but I thought I would explode from the anxiety. I just went down and down and down and down. We kept changing medications and I just kept going down. I believed my doctors. I always accepted that I would eventually come back to normal, but I couldn't wait. I couldn't even do the next minute. The things my mind said were, 'You don't even deserve to live. You are worthless. You are nothing. You are nobody.' And that was when I really started thinking about killing myself. You don't think in depression that you've put on a gray veil and are seeing the world through the haze of a bad mood. You think that the veil has been taken away the veil of happiness, and that now you're seeing truly. It's easy to exorcise the demons of schizophrenics because they believe that there is something foreign inside them. But it's much harder with depressed people because we believe we are seeing the truth. But the truth lies. Now, I became fascinated by that phrase, but the truth lies. What does it mean to think of a truth that lies? And I discovered if you're dealing with depressed people that they say a great many things which are clearly untrue. Someone who's depressed says, nobody loves me. And you can say, I love you, your wife loves you, your children love you, your friends love you. You can usually poke a hole in that. But there are also people who are depressed who will say things like, but no matter what we do, we're all just going to die in the end anyway. Or who'll say, we're each of us caught in our own body. There can be no true communion between two people. And you listen to people saying that and you think, well, that's true. But why don't we today focus on breakfast? And what's strange as you stop and think about it is that most of us aren't disabled by knowing those terrible difficulties. Most of us recognize those things are true and are in fact protected by a certain level of happiness. And I was particularly struck by the drama of this situation as revealed in a study that was done in which a group of depressed and a group of non-depressed people were asked to play a video game for an hour. And at the end of an hour, they were asked how many little monsters they thought they had killed. And the depressed people were mostly accurate to within 10%. And the non-depressed people guessed between 15 and 20 times as many little monsters as they had killed. So there we are. It's depression. It's the family secret that everybody has. And this business of trying to keep it a secret wears people down. I was at a conference shortly after I had done my initial writing on this topic. It was a weekend-long conference on another matter entirely. And on Friday, a woman took me aside and she said that she had been suffering from depression and that she had gotten some treatment and she wasn't sure she was on the right thing and what did I think and could I give her any advice and suggestions. And so we talked it through and I told her what I could. And she said, my husband is along at this conference, she said, and he's the kind of guy who just really couldn't understand this. She said, so I just want to make sure you won't say anything to anyone about it. And I said, no, don't worry about that, I absolutely won't. On Sunday of said conference, her husband took me aside and admitted that he was dealing with depression and asked me for some advice, and said, but please don't tell my wife, she wouldn't think I was a real guy if she knew. And it turned out they were taking the same medication and hiding it in two different places in the same bedroom. And I suggested that communication in the marriage might be getting in their way. But depression is so exhausting, and the silence only makes it worse. I often think of the story of someone who ran a very large company in Detroit that made the sunroofs for vehicles, who didn't want anyone to know that he was dealing with depression. In fact, he was so eager that people not know about that, that he chose not to include mental health care in the health plan at his company, lest it call attention to an interest, and who ended up killing himself. And I thought if all the energy he spent in keeping it secret had been devoted to getting better, how much more chance there might have been of his making it through for himself and for his employees. Now, I started off my research with a real sense that there were a very few proven treatments, and those were the ones that worked, and everything else was kind of ridiculous. I thought there's medication, there are various forms of therapy, but especially cognitive behavioral therapy, and there's electroconvulsive therapy, electroshock treatment, which is not the most pleasant treatment, but a very effective one. And then I began getting letters from people describing the results they'd had from all kinds of other therapies. And I began to shift my point of view. Because if you have brain cancer and you say that it makes you feel better to stand on your head for half an hour every morning, you may feel better, but you still have brain cancer and you'll still most likely die from it. But if you have depression and you say it makes you feel better to stand on your head for half an hour every morning, then you are better, because depression is an illness of how you feel. So if you feel better, you're not depressed anymore. So I became open to the possibility of things and paid attention to these letters that came in. I was particularly taken with a letter that came in from one woman who wrote to me and said that the thing that had been transformational for her after having failed therapy, electroshock treatment, and medication, and she hoped I would tell the world about it, was making little things from yarn. Some of which she sent to me. And none of which I'm wearing right now. I thought that she might want to investigate the diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive disorder. But I really did become convinced that there were an awful lot of things that could be effective. And I was very struck by the interviews I did with someone I've called Frank Rusakoff, who suffered from one of the most severe depressive conditions I've ever encountered. He had been perfectly fine until he was in his early 20s, and one day he was driving home from the movie theater, and he suddenly was so overcome with the wish to kill himself that he drove over to a hospital and checked himself in. And in the 12 years or so that followed, he ended up having constant treatment. He was on medication, and he would have electroconvulsive therapy, and then he would feel better for about, then he would feel disoriented for a week or so, which is what happens after ECT. Then he would feel sort of okay for a week. Then he would go downhill for a week, and then he would hit the rock bottom and return for his next round of ECT. And when I met him, he was pale and exhausted, and he said, "Can I really bear to go on this way?" And then he told me that there was a protocol for something called a cingulotomy, which was a procedure in which a small lesion is burned into the right anterior cingulum of the brain. He explained that he was considering doing that, and I thought, how can anyone who's been through such difficult and such painful experiences and who's had so little result still have the underlying optimism to try one more thing, to go off into the world and try this cingulotomy? But I admired the fact that he said he was ready to do it. And he described to me when he went there, after he came back, how creepy the experience was of hearing the drill going through his skull and of smelling the burning as the lesion was burned into his brain. But it was remarkably effective for him. It doesn't succeed for everyone. It's obviously a very extreme intervention. But for him, it was quite remarkable. And he sent me a letter the Christmas after the cingulotomy. And he said, "My dad gave me two presents this year. First, a motorized CD rack from the Sharper Image. It's totally unnecessary and extravagant, but my dad knew I'd get a kick out of it. I opened this huge box and saw something I didn't need and knew he was celebrating the fact that I'm living on my own, have a job I seem to love, and can pay my own bills. The other present was a photo of my grandmother who committed suicide. As I opened the present, I began to cry. She was beautiful. She's in profile, looking downwards. My mom came over to the chair and asked if I were crying because of all the relatives I never knew. And I said, she had the same disease I had. I'm crying now. It's not that I'm so sad. I just get overwhelmed. Maybe it's that I could have killed myself but didn't because those around me convinced me to keep going. And I had the surgery. I'm alive and grateful to my parents and some doctors. We live in the right time, even if it doesn't always seem like it." I was interested in that idea of living in the right time. But I was also interested in what a broad range of treatments there seemed to be for depression. And one of the things I wanted to establish in writing my book was that it is not the case, as people so often think, that depression is a modern, Western, middle-class illness. Depression has existed across history, it exists across cultures, and it exists across the social spectrum. And in looking at the issue of depression across cultures, I went off and examined depression among the Greenlandic Inuit, who are particularly prone to a condition which, I kid you not, is called kayak anxiety. I looked at depression among survivors of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And I went to West Africa because I was interested in the tribal rituals that are used for the treatment of depression there. And I had a...
Eno chapura esiku chemanguruko chanamibia ndo ndando tadishambura okuziyako Exodus Investment CC Mona omaramba takarongo konti vitango okuzapo odura ethiri janamibia Udunao utano o CCTV camera taurongo ko wifi Ikwa marujeno moka makwatirwa ongo dido TV Ite da kutuna o TV mekuma nege voka wakara ikare Kuma ekondijina u remota ojo ikwa marusheno Nikwa teknika o inji Tutare na pone na hapo kanduda okati heali Black China Shopping Center Omoka tutura povi no bengu bindoga Otopatura etimbo kehi No masiku uko mafudo Okuza poke tatu Yongura sigo opontano koma tango Kareka oka jampu mpoko kure inangoe Osho wono ngechefa o inendele kumbo joy Tu dengira nena Nenge utume oka tumara kako whatsapp Kono mora ongo Nerake datu imwe Datu imwe Ongoi imwe Datu ongoi non tano Watafuru okuturandula koma rungura Exodus Investment CC Ostura yoe Yine kewa moku etapo I kwa marushe no yonkushu. Enderea, ushoka ufandiza ituo, ushoka ya nuinua esi kujima nguru kwa otu. Wata ikuruo masko mirongo ndatuka apiriti. Onfura otu njik, dimburu kwa Exodus Investment CC. Atuvuruo okutuma irantitonga yoye oshiongo ashike. Ano, ohatuka uria oshiongo ashike tu dengera nina.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special angetashia kengeshe fa omarudi tayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafilane, egelesan, the eye.
A friend who was living in Senegal, and he had a Senegalese girlfriend, and I spoke to him and he said, well, you know, if you're interested in these things, why don't you come here and we'll see if we can do some research. So I arrived in Senegal, and I met my friend's then-girlfriend, now ex-wife, Hélène. And she said that she actually had a friend who was a cousin of someone who had gone to school with someone who had once met somebody who knew somebody else's long line of connections who actually performed the Undup, which was the tribal ritual I was particularly interested in seeing. And she suggested that we could actually interview this woman who performed the Undup. And I thought, this is fantastic, how terrific. So off we went to a sort of small town, a couple of hours outside of Dakar, and I met Madame Diop, who was this rather large and spectacular woman in yards and yards of African fabric printed with eyes, very dramatic manner. And she told me quite a bit about the Undup and how it's done and how it's performed. And I said that this was all very fascinating. And at the end of our conversation, she said to me, I hope this has been helpful. And I said, you know, it's been helpful. I said, I know this might be inappropriate. I said, but would there be any chance I could ever actually witness the Undup being performed? And she said, well, I've certainly never had a foreigner, the local word is tubab, I've never had a tubab there before, she said, but, you know, you've come through these friends and you seem genuinely interested. Yes, she said, the next time I perform one, you may be there. And I said, oh, that's completely fantastic. I said, I'm thrilled to hear it. I said, when are you next going to be doing one? And she said, oh, sometime in the next 6 months. And I said, 6 months is quite a long time for me to stay here waiting for one to come along. I said, is there any chance there's one that could be expedited a little bit? She said to me, no, that really isn't the way it works. So I said, well, I'm really sorry that I didn't get to see one. I said, but it's been really great meeting you. I said, I won't be able to stay here for that, but thank you so much. And she said, not at all. And I turned to go, and just as I was walking out the door, she said, excuse me, she said, and I said, yes. And she said, I hope you don't mind my saying this, but you don't look so great yourself. She said, are you by any chance suffering from depression? I said, well, I have. I'm sort of okay at the moment, but yes, that's, yes. And she said, well, I've certainly never done this for a foreigner before, but if you'd like,
I could do an end-up for you. And I said, oh, what an interesting idea. I said, yes, let's do an end-up for me. And I walked out, and Hélène turned to me, and she said, are you completely crazy? She said, you're completely crazy, but I'll help you if you want me to. So we had to do various preparatory things and put together various items. We had a long shopping list of things to buy. We bought all the items on the shopping list except the RAM that we were supposed to get. I said to Hélène, because we were doing it the day before the end up, I said, what about the RAM? And she said, if we get the RAM, what are we going to do with it overnight? So I saw the sense in that. And we picked the RAM up the next day on the way to the end up. The nature of the end-up is that it varies enormously depending on a variety of things that happen. You have a whole set of predictive activities, and there isn't time to go through the entire story right now, but I will tell you that the high point came when I found myself in a makeshift wedding bed in the central square of this town with the ram, whom I had to hold on to and who was enthusiastically urinating all over my leg. And the entire population of the village was dancing around us in concentric circles and throwing large sheets of fabric over us. It was making it very, very hot. And there were drums playing. And at a certain key moment, the fabric was yanked away. I was pulled to my feet. The loincloth that was all I was wearing was ripped from me. The ram's throat was slit. And I was covered in the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram. It was a far cry from my previous therapeutic experience. But I have to say that it ended up being, and it's hard to describe it all so quickly, it ended up being quite an extraordinary, and in many ways quite an exhilarating experience. And I met many people who had had undops who talked about their transformational power. And some years later, in researching my more recent book, I was in Rwanda doing interviews with people, and the subject somehow came up. And I described my end-up experience to someone I had met in Kigali, who said to me, you know, that's West Africa and this is East Africa, so we don't have anything that's quite like that, but we have things that are a little bit similar. He said, you know, we had a lot of trouble with Western mental health workers who came here after the genocide. And I said, oh, really? I said, what was the problem? And he said, okay. He said, they came, he said, they did not externalize the problem as an invasive spirit that could be got rid of, like the thing that you're describing. He said, it was not outside in the sun where you've got the sense of that light that helps you begin to feel better. He said, there was no drumming to kind of get your blood flowing. He said, and the whole community didn't come together that way and take a day off all to unite in trying to help you to recover and to acknowledge what was happening. He said, instead, they did this horrible thing. They took people one at a time into dingy little rooms and asked them to talk for 50 minutes about bad things that had happened to them. He said, we had to ask them to leave the country. I won't go into the historical models, but I'm going to read you something Hippocrates wrote 2,500 years ago in describing a condition that affected some of the patients he saw. He said it was an illness associated with the autumn, the symptoms of which included sadness, anxiety, moral dejection, tendency to suicide, aversion to food, despondency, sleeplessness, irritability, and restlessness, accompanied by prolonged fear. That was 2,500 years ago, and it sounds exactly like what you'd find in a psychiatric textbook today. So don't imagine this is a strange or modern or particular thing. And Hippocrates got into a great argument back and forth with Plato, because Hippocrates claimed that this was an organic dysfunction of the brain that should be treated by oral remedies, though we didn't have the oral remedies, that was what he believed. And Plato believed it was a philosophical problem that needed to be resolved through discourse and dialogue. And so that conflict between the medical model and the psychotherapeutic model is also 2,500 years old. Now, I mentioned that one of my concerns was to look at depression among people who were financially underprivileged, who were at the bottom of the social ladder. Depression isn't somehow a wonderful luxury for middle-class people. Depression is something that occurs all over the place. But if you have a basically very nice life and you feel utterly miserable all the time, you're likely to think, there's something wrong with me. And so you seek help and try to understand what it is. If you have a life which is grim and awful and agonizing, and you feel miserable all the time, it doesn't occur to you that you have an illness, because the way you feel seems to be commensurate with the circumstances of your life. But the reality often is that it's not that you feel miserable because your life is so awful, but rather, to some degree, that your life is so awful because you're depressed, and it's very hard when you're depressed to fix anything that's going wrong in any area of your life. And so I went to look at people who were being picked up in academic studies at the time who suffered from depression but didn't know it. And I met one professor who was screening women at a family planning clinic as they came in and trying to identify the ones who were depressed and who had a hard sell convincing them that they had depression and a hard sell convincing them that they should try treatment. But she began treatment, and she enrolled these women in group therapy and gave some of them medication. And I'm going to read you what one of them said at the time that she was brought in. I had a job, but I had to quit because I just couldn't do it. I don't want to get out of bed, and I feel like there's no reason to do anything. I'm already small, and I'm losing more and more weight. I don't get up to eat or anything. I just don't care. Sometimes I sit and just cry, cry, cry over nothing. I just cry. I just want to be by myself. I have nothing to say to my own children. After they leave the house, I get in bed with the door locked. I fear when they come home, 3 o'clock, and it just comes so fast. My husband keeps telling me I'm stupid, I'm dumb, I'm ugly. I've begun to take some medicine, mostly painkillers. It can be Tylenol or anything for pain. A lot of it, though, anything that'll put me to sleep. Well, when I met this woman 8 months later, she had ditched the abusive husband. She had gotten a job. She had gotten her children all reengaged with their academic work. And this is what she said to me. My kids are so much happier. They want to do things all the time now. We talk hours every day, and they're my best friends. As soon as I come home, in the door, I put my jacket down, purse, and we just get out books and read, doing homework all together and everything. We joke around. We all talk about careers, and before they didn't even think careers. My eldest wants to go to the Air Force. One wants to be a firefighter, one a preacher, and one of the girls is going to be a lawyer. I talk to them about drugs, and they keep clean now. They don't cry like they used to, and they don't fight like they did. I let them know they can talk to me about anything. I don't care what it is. There's one room in the new place for the boys, and one for the girls, and one for me. But they all just like to get up on my bed with me, and we're all sitting around there at night. That's all I need now is my kids. I never thought I would get this far. It feels good to be happy. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I sure hope it's forever. And things keep on changing. The way I dress, the way I look, the way I act, the way I feel. I'm not afraid anymore. I can walk out the door not being afraid. I don't think those bad feelings are coming back. And if it weren't for Dr. Miranda and that, I'd still be at home in bed, if I were still alive at all. I asked the Lord to send me an angel, and he answered my prayers. I met many people who had been drawn into protocols of this kind, and not all of them emerged as articulate as this particular woman, but I saw these extraordinary stories of transformation. And so I pursued two responses to that. The first was that I said I wanted to write a piece for my editors at the New York Times Magazine, and they agreed to the commission, and I turned the piece in, and an editor called me and said, Andrew, we can't publish this. And I said, oh, really, why not? And she said, look, she said, it just seems kind of ridiculous. I mean, you have these women, they're completely failing to function. The next thing you know, they're virtually ready to go out and run Morgan Stanley. She said, I've never heard of anything like it. And I said, the fact that you've never heard of anything like it is what makes it news. You are running a news magazine. I then went down to talk to people on Capitol Hill about it because I thought that what I had seen was so compelling, because it seemed to me that it was not only a humanitarian error not to help people like the ones I had been interviewing in these contexts, it was also an economic error. Here was someone who was living on welfare with children headed into the juvenile justice system, who instead had children who are planning to join the Air Force and become lawyers and who are self to become a productive member of the economy. That had to be an enormous, enormous savings of cost. And her treatment had effectively cost pennies. And so I went down and I met with the two people, now both gone, in the Senate who were at that time the most active in the field of mental health care. And the first was Pete Domenici, Republican of New Mexico. And he said to me, I believe what you're saying, that it would serve our humanitarian and our economic interest to treat this population. But it isn't going to happen because this Congress resists mandates, especially in health care. And he said, and it isn't going to happen because we have a line item budget. And how can I take something out of one of the justice system this year to put into setting up programs like this? And he went on and on with all of these technicalities. And then I met with Paul Wellstone. And he said to me, there's no question that what you've said is true and that it would serve every form of interest for us to treat these people. But I'll tell you why it's not going to happen for now. It's not going to happen because we live in a representative democracy. And in a representative democracy, all of the voters have representation here on Capitol Hill. But the people you're talking about aren't voters. On election day, they're at home with the covers pulled up over their heads, not in the polling stations. And so they don't have any representation up here on Capitol Hill. And nobody else cares about them. And to set up the kind of programs you're describing would involve investing enormous political capital, and nobody is going to do it if their voters don't care about it. So if you'd like to see it change, let people know about this reality, which is why I'm letting you know about it. So let me think about this question of antidepressants. Think about this question of whether they're natural, which people come up with over and over and over again. Think about the fact that toothpaste is not natural. It's natural for your teeth to fall out, but we don't militate against dental hygiene. I have found that in the process of coming out of depression and seeing the people I'm looking at coming out of depression, that people do not become somehow these happy automatons that everybody has an anxiety and fear about. They manage to be sad differently and in different ways. I, for example, feel sad about global warming, and I feel sad about the situation in the Middle East, and I feel sad about some personal relationships that haven't turned out the way I hoped that they would. Instead of feeling sad about having to have lunch or sad about having to listen to the messages on my answering machine. And I wanted to look at what the mechanisms of that resilience were. Why are the people I've described to you all people who have managed to have good lives around their depression? And I found something strange and somewhat ironic, which is that people who have had a depression and then want to walk away from it and not think about it and close themselves off from it are ironically the ones who are most haunted by it. And the people who do really well are the ones who actually, after they've had a depression, integrate that experience of depression into their day-to-day lives. It is not that doing that prevents a relapse. It doesn't prevent a relapse. We're all prone to relapse. What it does is allow people to be better prepared to tolerate that relapse when it comes. So I'm going to read you just a couple of short quotes from the people we talked about in the earlier part of the lecture. Frank Rusakoff, the guy who had the cingulotomy, said to me, "If I had it all to do over again, I wouldn't do it this way. But I think I have gained a lot and grown a lot because of it. I've become a lot closer to my parents, to my brother, to friends. I have this experience with my doctor that's been very good. There really are upsides to depression. It's just hard to see them when you're in it. I said I would do it differently if I had it to do over again, and I guess I would. But now that I feel like the worst is over, I'm grateful for having been where I've been. I do believe I am better off having been to the hospital 30 times and having had brain surgery. I've met a lot of good people along the way. I'm pleased to tell you that he's also remained a friend. I had dinner with him last week in Maryland, where he lives with his wife and his two children, in a state of really significant happiness and success. Maggie Robbins, who talked about the idea that the truth lies, said, I used to get nervous a lot, and I would just talk and talk. And then I started volunteering at an AIDS residence. They had teas there, and I was supposed to help get the tea and cake and juice for the patients, and to sit with them and chat, because many of them didn't have people to visit them and were lonely. I remember one day early on, I sat down with some of them and asked what they'd done for the 4th of July. They told me, but they just weren't keeping up their end of the conversation at all. I thought, this is not very friendly or helpful of them. And then it hit me. These guys aren't going to make small talk. In fact, after those first few short answers, they weren't going to talk at all. But they didn't want me to leave. So I decided, I'm here with them, and I'm going to be with them. It's simply going to be an occasion when I'm a person who doesn't have AIDS and doesn't look really sick and isn't dying, but who can tolerate the fact that they do, and they are. And so I just stayed with them that afternoon without talking. The loving is that you are there, simply paying attention unconditionally. If suffering is what the person is doing right then, that's what they're doing. You're being with that, not crying like crazy to do something about it. I've learned how to do that. Our needs are our greatest assets. I guess I've learned to give all the things I need. And Laura Anderson, who thought about chewing on that leaf and drifting off into death, said, depression has given me kindness and forgiveness where other people don't know enough to extend it. I am drawn toward people who might put off others with a wrong move or a misplaced barb. I had an argument about the death penalty tonight with someone, and I was trying to explain, without being too self-referential, that one can understand horrifying actions, understand the terrible links between mood and job and relationships and the rest of everything. I would never want depression to be a public or political excuse, but I think that once you have gone through it, you get a greater and more immediate understanding of the temporary absence of judgment that makes people behave so badly. You learn even, perhaps, how to tolerate the evil in the world. So as I've said, valuing the depression doesn't prevent relapse, but I think it is the cornerstone of resilience, which is not to say depressions are wonderful, and if you haven't had one, go out and have one now. It's only to say, if you're stuck with it, and it is your reality, recognize that there are lessons in it. Recognize that there are little bits of resilience that can be achieved. Recognize that to make something of it is a choice. For myself, when I am depressed, I can't talk about being depressed. I've written a book. I've done public lectures. You couldn't be much more public about your depression. But when I have an occasional little relapse, I have to cancel things and I say, I seem to have food poisoning, or I'm really sorry I'm going to be out of town, or I say all kinds of other things because when I'm depressed, it's more than I can do to talk about it. But when I'm not depressed, then I can talk about it, and then I can think about it. And I can think how that experience showed me the intensity that emotions can rise to, how powerful they can be, how they can determine our whole life experience. I said that the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And vitality is the thing that has come back to me when I am not depressed and that has felt so incalculably precious when it's there. Sometimes people have thought that the way that I live my life when I'm not depressed might almost be bipolar because it seems manic, but it isn't. It's only that I don't know in any given time how long I'll go on feeling all right. And I want to make the most of those moments, to live them as fully as I can. I felt the funeral in my brain. I felt sundered, But I learned a lot of things I wouldn't have known until that day when hell came to pay me a surprise visit. I think that having been depressed, I love every moment of not being depressed, that I find and cling to the reasons for joy, and that every day I gamely side with the reasons for living and not dying. And for me, that's turned out to be the most privileged possible rapture. Thank you.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're still here on our roller coaster of heartstrings. So, when life feels too heavy, how are we gonna curb it? How are we gonna curb it? How are we gonna curb it? Because we are all about survival tonight.
Hey, Psych2Goers. Depression. When does it creep into your life? You never know. I first experienced depression in middle school. As a preteen, I naturally wasn't able to tell how my mind was working differently. Probably the most common features in a scenario like that is depression and sadness being somewhat interchangeable terms for you because you haven't learned the difference yet at that age. In fact, it probably wasn't until my 27th birthday when I realized how truly separate the two were. When I spent a week unable to leave the house despite being in a pretty great mood. And really, for two-thirds of my life at that point, I'd only experienced depression in terms of extreme sadness or lethargy in response to an event, usually interpersonal. Most of what I've learned about it has come from the past 5 years. As a preteen, I experienced a great deal of depression, or sadness as I would call it then, mainly due to academic, social, and presumably hormonal difficulties. Being a perfect example of your inherent shy kid of the family left me nihilistic. I was often finding ways to try to draw attention to myself. Passively, of course, because of shyness. From drawings and writings to song lyrics, I began to express what I was going through in a number of different ways. For the sake of expression and as a way to prove myself as more capable than the person I negatively perceived myself to be. Somewhere between middle school and early high school, I degraded emotionally to a great extent. I began making threats of self-harm and was even pulled out of public school. When this happened, I also went from 110 pounds to a staggering 160 over the course of about 3 months due to the medication I was on. Throughout most of 2002, I smiled in exactly zero photos, including a professionally done family portrait. I now recognize that this was stated and deliberate, a sort of generalized clapback against the outside world because of how I felt. I would sometimes be needlessly bitter, stubborn, even explosive, and I often spent all evening in my room playing video games or watching TV. Although I never stopped drawing, I did stop experimenting with crafts like collage and writing, etc. The lowest moment was likely after committing a particularly upsetting form of self-harm, which I covered up with a bowling glove. This only attracted attention to it, and in no time the secret was wide in the open, causing me to double down on attention-seeking behavior. There were brushes with depression throughout the decade. A more chronic form of depression arrived in my late 20s, as I finally got my bachelor's degree and faced a difficult job market living in Atlanta. a decision was made to apply to grad school. While undergrad was easily one of the happiest periods of my life, grad school was much more complicated and came with persistent bouts of depression and anxiety. I was substantially less social and prone to spending hours laying on the couch, either playing with my phone or doing nothing at all. I would stare at the ceiling or bury my head between the pillow and cushions. Most of grad school was backlit by anxiety and depression, bouncing off of each other. However, I became much more proactive in my mental health as a result, and eventually settled on a prescription regimen that I still follow today. I then started regular therapy for the first time as an adult, which I've mostly kept up with since then. Following grad school, I moved yet again and spent all of 2019 squeezing as much employability as possible out of my extremely narrow window of interest in commercial work. An intensive outpatient program via Zoom kept me afloat on 3 therapy sessions a week. And looking back over the past year, I can see my mood as something zigzagging like the chart of a tumultuous, but slow upward trending company on the stock market. Over time, rock bottom becomes a little higher than before, and the good days become more like actual good days than simply normal. Much of this time was spent in a suffocating, crowded, and dark apartment, and taught me an important lesson about considering the mental health impact when looking for apartments on a budget. Over the decades, I've had a number of methods of dealing with depression that weren't particularly healthy. The ones that were healthy, however, often involved distraction or turning to friends. Distraction could mean driving around and listening to music, a rural pastime, for sure, or it could mean something more hobby-oriented. The video game collection I mentioned earlier continues on and off to this day, and opened up a little time capsule to turn on in moments of stress and escapism. However, if not handled correctly, this hobby becomes detrimental very quickly. Escapism can limit one's ability to make a real change in their life and improve their situation. Art was far and away the healthiest channel for me to process and express things going on in my life, and it has always run the gamut. I've experimented in essentially every type of drawing I could get my hands on, and most types of paintings and photography. As a preteen, I would work with clay as well as modifying existing toys to make new things out of them. Picture Sid from Toy Story, but less nefarious, even though I had the same t-shirt. More than anything, though, simple drawing and writing have been my go-to formats. In pursuing animation, I made films about subjects like depression, anxiety, grief, and emotional dependency. I was able to unload the things that weighed on me and make a recognizable, semi-permanent change in my mental state. As I entered my 30s, I started regular therapy and learned a host of other skills and coping mechanisms, many of which I still use today. I try to walk outside as much as I can, as walks outside can carry a lot of benefits. Others include journaling, mindfulness, meditation, and self-parenting. All of these have helped me get through several periods of stagnation to the current day. Where I've had a number of breakthroughs as to the causes of my psychological struggles and have been able to work on them directly and make plans for treatment that's not only more effective but potentially more permanent. Depression arrives in many forms and can disguise itself as sadness, lethargy, apathy, and others. I've learned that recognizing depression can be deceptively difficult because when it's at its worst, it has your mind under its control. And it gets harder to differentiate the real world from the dystopia that depression will convince you is real. Time helps, as does mindfulness, exercise, and spending time with loved ones, if at all possible. And no matter how long you've dealt with it, you can always let your guard down without noticing. It's important to try the things that work, but the most important part is maintaining some semblance of effort trying to wrestle control from depression's grip so you can steer yourself in the right direction. It may mean complete control, or just pulling the wheel in the right direction every time you get your hands on it. Either way, the most important and often seemingly hardest part is simply trying. That often means physically getting up to do something that will make you feel better, not the thing that will give you a burst of dopamine, like frivolous spending or junk food. It's also very important to keep in mind that this is a process, not a simple cause and effect solution. The most important word in this video's title is overcome, as opposed to the past tense, overcame. It can go away, sure, but it will almost certainly take time and it can come back. Dealing with depression is not a singular act. It's a pattern of good habits. The knowledge of what activities will provide you with the greatest improvements in mood and what activities will be a temporary distraction. Your most important decisions when dealing with depression, outside of the medical choices you make, will be the lifestyle you live and the way you treat yourself and others. Has your experience with depression been like this? Or different? If you have a perspective you think could help others know when to see a doctor or therapist, please let us know in the comments below. Hey, Psych2Goers. Have you ever wondered what depression feels like? Or if you have depression, do you struggle with describing how it feels to others? What most people don't understand is that depression is much more than having a bad day or an off week. It's a mood disorder that causes constant feelings of sadness, disinterest, and emptiness. Because it affects someone mentally, physically, and socially, most people don't have a good understanding of what it feels like. So to try to describe what it's like, to give you a better understanding of depression, here is how some may experience depression on a daily basis. Number one, waking up exhausted and drained. Have you ever stayed up really late and woke up feeling awful? Imagine that, but every day. Oftentimes, regardless of how much sleep someone with depression gets, they'll wake up without any energy. This lack of energy makes it hard for them to get out of bed and do daily tasks that seem automatic to people without depression. You can think of depression as an invisible weight that brings you down everywhere you go. You may not be able to see it, but it's always there, making life harder. Number two, feeling as if there's no joy in life. Have you ever tried to pay attention to a class you didn't enjoy at all? Time seems to go slower, and all you can do is count the minutes until it's over. People suffering from depression might feel as if there's no joy or pleasure in their life at all, making them uninterested in everything, in everyday life. Everyone has a hard time concentrating on things they don't enjoy, such as homework or chores. But what happens when someone doesn't enjoy life in general? Likely, they'll become unresponsive and unfocused on the world around them. So far, do you relate to these 2 points? Psych2Go is about encouraging people to open up about their struggles. Comment below your story if you relate to this, and we'll highlight the most impactful one in a future video. Your story helps others. Number three, low self-esteem. Do you compare yourself to all the models and influencers on social media? People with depression often do the same, but on a much larger scale. It goes much deeper than thinking that their body isn't picture perfect. Instead, they'll relate it to thinking that they're a failure as a person, family member, friend, and everything else. They may see everyone around them living happily and think it's their fault that they're struggling. Of course, that isn't the case, since depression is no one's fault. But just like trying to stop comparing yourself to social media, trying to stop thinking you're a failure is extremely difficult. Number four, complicated relationship with food. Do you ever eat because you feel sad, bored, or lonely, even though you're not hungry? Much like eating to pass time, people suffering from depression may use food as a coping mechanism. They could overeat to distract themselves from how they feel or to avoid feeling numb. Or, on the other hand, some with depression may also undereat. They may feel too numb or uninterested to the point where they see all food to be unappetizing. In cases like this, it's important you avoid phrases like, "You should be grateful you have the option to eat," or "You're taking what you have for granted." Instead, you might want to listen to why they're not eating healthily and try to keep in mind that it's not something that can be fixed overnight. Number five, everything feels hopeless. Do you ever feel like things will never get better? Whether pandemic related or not, everyone can think of a time where they felt helpless and hopeless. But people with depression feel hopeless, not just about the state of the world, but about themselves as well. They may think they'll never amount to everything or that they'll never learn how to cope with depression. This constant state of hopelessness can lead to them feeling exhausted and unmotivated all the time. Number six, unhealthy sleeping patterns. Ever had trouble sleeping? Maybe you were tossing and turning because you were nervous about a job interview in the morning. Many people with depression struggle with this every night. Depression is sometimes linked to other struggles such as insomnia and anxiety, both of which make sleeping even harder. On the other hand, someone with depression could also sleep too much as well, since they may see it as an escape from their daily struggles. Either way, having a healthy sleeping pattern is important for your mind and body, and without one, you're more likely to feel exhausted, irritable, and stressed. And number 7, physical pain. Imagine the worst headache you've ever had. Now imagine getting that around once every 2 weeks. While many people think mental and physical health are completely separate, they actually overlap in many ways. For example, people with depression are more prone to body aches, headaches, nausea, and muscle tension. So while you may have trouble understanding the complex thoughts and feelings people with depression have, you may be more able to empathize with them knowing what physical pain is like. So, did our video help you better understand what depression feels like? If you haven't yet commented your story, we encourage ahead. Lately, you've been finding it hard to enjoy life. You have low self-worth and feel like there is no point in pursuing your goals. Hopelessness, low self-esteem, and lack of interest and enjoyment are all signs of clinical depression, according to the NHS. If you feel this way too, we want you to know that you are not alone. We're here to support you, give you hope, and help you find ways to get through this. In today's video, we're going to offer you 4 tips on how to help you cope with depression that are recommended by psychologists and supported by research. We're also going to teach you concepts you might not have heard of, like behavioral theory of depression. Keep watching to learn more, to discover new strategies you can add to your mental health toolbox. Build a sense of mastery. According to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, setting small, achievable goals and celebrating even your little wins can help with depression. How can you implement this into your everyday life? Imagine that you have a school assignment or work project to finish. Doing the whole thing all at once might seem too daunting. Instead of just setting one big goal of completing this project, set little goals along the way. Step 1 might be writing the intro. Step 2 could be doing the background research, and so on. Successfully finishing each of these steps will help you build momentum and feel more confident that you can achieve your larger goal of finishing the project. This is one example of how you can build a sense of mastery. You've probably heard that exercise is an effective way to cope with depression, but did you know that part of the reason why it works is because it helps you build a sense of mastery? Dr. Alan Valentine, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, recommends exercise to his depressed patients because it helps with depression by providing a sense of achievement. Whether it's finishing a project, building a workout routine, or picking up a new hobby, focusing on mastering small skills can help you cope with depression. Reduce rumination. According to an article published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, people with depression tend to ruminate a lot on negative experiences, which can worsen their symptoms. Ruminating too often can send you into a downward spiral, especially if you're depressed. Do you find yourself getting stuck in negative thought patterns often? Psychologist Alicia Clark suggests using gratitude to stop negative rumination and change your mindset. Let's take a second to try Dr. Clark's gratitude exercise together. Think about 3 things that you're grateful for right now. No matter how small they are, it could be a friend or something that happened today that made you feel happier. Focus on how these things or people make you feel. The next time you catch yourself ruminating about something negative, pause and write down 3 things that you're grateful for. Behavioral theory of depression. Megan Rice, a therapist at Talkspace, says that one way to cope with depression is to add rewards into your daily routine. This technique is based on the behavioral theory of depression. A Journal of Medical Internet Research article states that according to behavioral therapy, doing activities that are important to you and feel rewarding, like spending time with loved ones or pursuing a new hobby, are an important part of treating depression. Having a daily schedule that includes mental health coping strategies can also help you keep active, have something to look forward to each day, and prevent you from falling into a rut. So what are some things that you can do each day that feel rewarding? Leave your ideas in the comments below. Challenge distortions. Cognitive distortions are negative beliefs that aren't based in reality. If you have a bad experience, do you tend to focus on the negative and believe that things will always go poorly? For instance, if you're feeling down, you may have thoughts like, I'll never get through this. I'm always gonna feel sad. This is an example of a cognitive distortion called overgeneralization. A study by Blake and colleagues in 2018 found that people with depression have more cognitive distortions than those without depression. According to Psych Central, one effective way to challenge cognitive distortions is to make a thought log. To create your own thought log, start off by writing down the situations you're in. Then write down everything you're feeling and thinking. Next.
Egameno jomau yerere koko marungura, kalishi ashike upsakadi opau teknika, oliriwo omkundu opashiguana, upsakadi opaliko, no hashivuro okuyamoshipara, uhupiro uongeshefa, oshinimomtumba gonamibia international cyber security conference and exhibition omvomao vigajo mirongo balinaha mano, iikondo epangero mahanga no opau mwene, uministeri wepangero ni ikondo ya yoroka no handimwe, onetamu isanwa, muhoroke komtumba omtitatu watumburwa metete. Tekero esikwa mirongo mbalinaga alisikwa mbalinaga nega apiriri mwavigali mirongo mbalinaga mano ekaroko Arembush Travel Lodge movenduka oshiparashi kundathanwa okwanja gane kuyerere kombinga ukoshoki wopa ungomba ano cyber hygiene kena una okuironge kithira omashongo kumarungura no marongo kehopopeko jerongizo jomarungura na irwe inji koneka omahangano ohandimwe ni ikondo mbokata mkatuma akaliripo ya konda pantu ya tano otamukapewa ompi ito yom tugumwe awedho apo hasho ashikeshoka pethimbo yom tumba gotungoka otakukakara o VIP cyber gala dinner nuyere ronji wa maisha angizo no mapura apuro watathana nayo konoraje tatu imwe onda tuyatano omgoijeari nenge ko email info@dstech.com.na nenge utarele pwepanja jao jopa ungomba ko www.dstech.com.na Namibia International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition Securing Namibia Digital Future.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukulile oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe mbali heali nola natu heali mbali no heali ile konderewa nora etatu natu mbali o etatu batatu omafelane Eagle FM the eye.
For a really long time, I had two mysteries that were hanging over me. I didn't understand them, and to be honest, I was quite afraid to look into them. The first mystery was, I'm 40 years old, and all throughout my lifetime, year after year, serious depression and anxiety have risen in the United States, in Britain, and across the Western world. And I wanted to understand why. Why is this happening to us? Why is it that with each year that passes, more and more of us are finding it harder to get through the day? And I wanted to understand this because of a more personal mystery. When I was a teenager, I remember going to my doctor and explaining that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me. I couldn't control it. I didn't understand why it was happening. I felt quite ashamed of it. And my doctor told me a story that I now realize was well-intentioned, but quite oversimplified, not totally wrong. My doctor said, well, we know why people get like this. Some people just naturally get a chemical imbalance in their heads. You're clearly one of them. All we need to do is give you some drugs. It'll get your chemical balance back to normal. So I started taking a drug called Paxil or Ceroxat. It's the same thing with different names in different countries. And I felt much better. I got a real boost. But not very long afterwards, this feeling of pain started to come back. So I was given higher and higher doses until for 13 years I was taking the maximum possible dose that you're legally allowed to take. And for a lot of those 13 years, and pretty much all the time by the end, I was still in a lot of pain. And I started asking myself, well, what's going on here? Because you're doing everything you're told to do by the story that's dominating the culture. Why do you still feel like this? So to get to the bottom of these two mysteries, For a book that I've written, I ended up going on a big journey all over the world. I traveled over 40,000 miles. I wanted to sit with the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety, and crucially, what solves them, and people who've come through depression and anxiety and out the other side in all sorts of ways. And I learned a huge amount from the amazing people I got to know along the way. But I think at the heart of what I learned is, so far, we have scientific evidence for 9 different causes of depression and anxiety. 2 of them are indeed in our biology. Your genes can make you more sensitive to these problems, though they don't write your destiny. And there are real brain changes that can happen when you become depressed that can make it harder to get out. But most of the factors that have been proven to cause depression and anxiety are not in our biology. They're factors in the way we live. And once you understand them, it opens up a very different set of solutions that should be offered to people alongside the option of chemical antidepressants. For example, if you're lonely, you're more likely to become depressed. If when you go to work, you don't have any control over your job, you've just got to do what you're told, you're more likely to become depressed. If you very rarely get out into the natural world, you're more likely to become depressed. And one thing unites a lot of the causes of depression and anxiety that I learned about, not all of them, but a lot of them. Everyone here knows you've all got natural physical needs, right? Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd all be in real trouble real fast. But at the same time, every human being has natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. And this culture we built is good at lots of things. Many things are better than in the past. I'm glad to be alive today. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs. And it's not the only thing that's going on, but I think it's the key reason why this crisis keeps rising and rising. And I found this really hard to absorb. I really wrestled with the idea of shifting from thinking of my depression as, you know, just a problem in my brain to one with many causes, including many in the way we're living. And it only really began to fall into place for me when one day I went to interview a South African psychiatrist named Dr. Derek Summerfield, who's a great guy. And Dr. Summerfield happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when they first introduced chemical antidepressants for people in that country. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, had never heard of these drugs, so they were like, what are they? And he explained. And they said to him, oh, we don't need them. We've already got antidepressants. And he was like, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy like, I don't know, St. John's wort, ginkgo biloba, something like that. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who worked in the rice fields. And one day he stood on a landmine left over from the war with the United States and he got his leg blown off. So they gave him an artificial leg and after a while he went back to work in the rice fields. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial limb. And I'm guessing it was pretty traumatic to go back and work in the field where he got blown up. The guy started to cry all day. He refused to get out of bed. He developed all the symptoms of classic depression. The Cambodian doctor said, this is when we gave him an antidepressant. And Dr. Summerfield said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. It was hard for him to see it in the throes of his depression, but actually it had perfectly understandable causes in his life. One of the doctors, talking to the people in the community, figured, you know, if we bought this guy a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was screwing him up so much. He wouldn't have to go and work in the rice fields. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. They said to Dr. Summerfield, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right?
Yep, yep, yeah,
I agree.
If you've
been raised to think about depression the way I was and most of the people here were, that sounds like a bad joke, right? I went to my doctor for an antidepressant. She gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively, based on this individual unscientific anecdote, is what the leading medical body in the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years, based on the best scientific evidence. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, You're not weak. You're not crazy. You're not, in the main, a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs. And it's just as important to think here about what those Cambodian doctors and the World Health Organization are not saying. They did not say to this farmer, hey, buddy, you need to pull yourself together. It's your job to figure out and fix this problem on your own. On the contrary, what they said is, we're here as a group to pull together with you. So together we can figure out and fix this problem. This is what every depressed person needs, and it's what every depressed person deserves. This is why one of the leading doctors at the United Nations, in their official statement for World Health Day a couple of years back in 2017, said we need to talk less about chemical imbalances and more about the imbalances in the way we live. Drugs give real relief to some people. They gave relief to me for a while. But precisely because this problem goes deeper than their biology, the solutions need to go much deeper too. But when I first learned that, I remember thinking, okay, I could see all the scientific evidence. I read a huge number of studies, interviewed a huge number of the experts who were explaining this. I kept thinking, all right, but how can we possibly do that, right? The things that are making us depressed are in most cases more complex than what was going on with this Cambodian farmer. Where do we even begin with that insight? But then in the long journey for my book, all over the world, I kept meeting people who were doing exactly that, from Sydney to San Francisco to Sao Paulo. I kept meeting people who were understanding the deeper causes of depression and anxiety and, as groups, fixing them. So obviously I can't tell you about all the amazing people that I got to know and wrote about, or all of the 9 causes of depression and anxiety that I learned about, because they won't let me give a 10-hour TED talk. You can complain about that to them. But I want to focus on 2 of the causes and 2 of the solutions that emerge from them, if that's all right. Here's the first. We are the loneliest society in human history. There was a recent study that asked Americans, do you feel like you're no longer close to anyone? And 39% of people said that described them, no longer close to anyone. In the international measurements of loneliness, Britain and the rest of Europe are just behind the US, in case anyone here is feeling smug. And I spent a lot of time discussing this with the leading expert in the world on loneliness, an incredible man named Professor John Cacioppo, who was at Chicago. And I thought a lot about one question his work poses to us. So Professor Cacioppo asked, why do we exist? Why are we here? Why are we alive? One key reason is that our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down a lot of the time. They weren't faster than the animals they took down a lot of the time. But they were much better at banding together into groups and cooperating. This was our superpower as a species. We band together. Just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. And we are the first humans ever to disband our tribes. And it is making us feel awful. But it doesn't have to be this way. One of the heroes in my book, and in fact in my life, is a doctor named Sam Everington. He's a general practitioner in a poor part of East London where I lived for many years. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with terrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they give some relief to some people. But he could see 2 things. Firstly, his patients were depressed and anxious a lot of the time for totally understandable reasons, like loneliness. And secondly, although the drugs were giving some relief to some people, for many people they didn't solve the problem, the underlying problem. So one day Sam decided to pioneer a different approach. A woman came to his center, his medical center, called Lisa Cunningham. I got to know Lisa later. And Lisa had been shut away in her home with crippling depression and anxiety for 7 years. And when she came to Sam's center, she was told, don't worry, we'll carry on giving you these drugs, but we're also going to prescribe something else. We're going to prescribe for you to come here to this center twice a week to meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, not to talk about how miserable you are, but to figure out something meaningful you can all do together so you won't be lonely and you won't feel like life is pointless. The first time this group met, Lisa literally started vomiting with anxiety. It was so overwhelming for her. But people rubbed her back. The group started talking. They were like, what could we do? These are inner city East London people like me. They didn't know anything about gardening. They were like, why don't we learn gardening? There was an area behind the doctor's offices that was just like scrubland. They're like, why don't we make this into a garden? So they started to take books out of the library. They started to watch YouTube clips. They started to get their fingers in the soil. They started to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But they started to do something even more important. They started to form a tribe. They started to form a group. They started to care about each other. If one of them didn't show up, the others would go looking for them, say, hey, you okay? Help them figure out what was troubling them that day. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. This approach is called social prescribing. It's spreading all over Europe. And there's a small but growing body of evidence suggesting it can produce real and meaningful falls in depression and anxiety. And one day I remember standing in the garden that Lisa and her once depressed friends had built. It's a really beautiful garden. And having this thought, it's very much inspired by a guy called Professor Hugh Mackay in Australia. I was thinking, you know, so often when people feel down in this culture, what we say to them, I'm sure everyone here said it, I have, is we say, oh, you just need to be you, be yourself. And I realized actually what we should say to people is, don't be you, don't be yourself, be us, be we, be part of a group. The solution to these problems does not lie in drawing more and more on your resources as an isolated individual. That's partly what got us into this crisis. It lies on reconnecting with something bigger than you. And that really connects to one of the other causes of depression and anxiety that I wanted to talk to you about. So everyone knows junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick. I don't say that with any sense of superiority. I literally came to give this talk from McDonald's. But I saw all of you eating that healthy TED breakfast. I was like, no way. But just like junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. For thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel like crap, right? That's not an exact quote from Schopenhauer, but that is the gist of what he said, right? But weirdly, hardly anyone had scientifically investigated this until a truly extraordinary person I got to know named Professor Tim Kasser, who's at Knox College in Illinois. And he's been researching this for about 30 years now. And his research suggests several really important things. Firstly, the more you believe you can buy and display your way out of sadness and into a good life, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious. And secondly, as a society, we have become much more driven by these beliefs. All throughout my lifetime, under the weight of advertising and Instagram and everything like them. And as I thought about this, I realized it's like we've all been fed since birth a kind of KFC for the soul. We've been trained to look for happiness in all the wrong places. And just like junk food doesn't meet your nutritional needs and actually makes you feel terrible, junk values don't meet your psychological needs. And they take you away from a good life. But when I first spent time with Professor Kasser and I was learning all this, I felt a really weird mixture of emotions. Because on the one hand, I found this really challenging. I could see how often in my own life, when I felt down, I tried to remedy it with some kind of show-offy, grand, external solution. And I could see why that did not work well for me. But I also thought, isn't this kind of obvious? Isn't this almost like banal, right? If I said to everyone here, none of you are going to lie on your deathbed and think about all the shoes you bought and all the retweets you got, right? You're going to think about moments of love and meaning and connection in your life. I think that seems almost like a cliche, but I kept talking to Professor Kasser and saying, you know, why am I feeling this strange doubleness? And he said, well, at some level, we all know these things, but in this culture, we don't live by them. We know them so well, they become cliches, but we don't live by them. I kept asking, well, why? Why would that be? Why would we know something so profound but not live by it? And after a while, Professor Kasser said to me, because we live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is important about life. I had to really think about that, because we live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is important about life. And Professor Kasser wanted to figure out if we can disrupt that machine. He's done loads of research into this. I'll tell you about one example, and I really urge everyone here to try this. with their friends and their family. So with a guy called Nathan Dungan, he got a group of teenagers and adults to come together for a series of sessions over a period of time to meet up. And part of the point of the group was to get people to think about a moment in their life they had actually found meaning and purpose. For different people, it was different things. Some people, it was playing music, writing, helping someone. I'm sure everyone here can picture something, right? And part of the point of the group was to get people to ask, okay, how could you dedicate more of your life to pursuing these moments of meaning and purpose and less to, I don't know, buying crap you don't need, putting it on social media and trying to get people to go, OMG, so jealous, right? And what they found was just having these meetings, it was like a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous for consumerism, right? Just getting people to have these meetings, articulate these values, determined to act on them and check in with each other, led to a marked shift in people's values. It took them away from this hurricane of depression-generating messages, training us to seek happiness in the wrong places, and towards more meaningful and nourishing values that lift us out of depression. But with all the solutions that I saw and have written about, and many I can't talk about here, I kept thinking, you know, why did it take me so long to see these insights, right? Because when you explain them to people, I mean, some of them are more complicated, but not all. When you explain this to people, it's not like rocket science, right? At some level, we already know these things. Why do we find it so hard to understand? I think there's many reasons, but I think one reason is that we have to change our understanding of what depression and anxiety actually are. There are very real biological contributions to depression and anxiety. But if we allow the biology to become the whole picture, as I did for so long, as I would argue our culture has done pretty much for most of my life, what we're implicitly saying to people is, and this isn't anyone's intention, but what we're implicitly saying to people is, your pain doesn't mean anything. It's just a malfunction. It's like a glitch in a computer program. It's just a wiring problem in your head. But I was only able to start changing my life when I realized your depression is not a malfunction. It's a signal. Your depression is a signal. It's telling you something. We feel this way for reasons, and they can be hard to see in the throes of depression. I understand that really well from personal experience. But with the right help, we can understand these problems and we can fix these problems together. But to do that, the very first step is we have to stop insulting these signals by saying they're a sign of weakness or madness or purely biological, except for a tiny number of people. We need to start listening to these signals because they're telling us something we really need to hear. It's only when we truly listen to these signals and we honor these signals and respect these signals that we're going to begin to see the liberating, nourishing, deeper solutions, the cows that are waiting all around us. Thank you.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe fa yapumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna ebito danjuka okukwetera oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetera o special angeta shake ngejefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamoili nawa ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu oma filane Eagle FM the eye.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen. So, I think today has been a roller coaster of information. So, listen, we are also going to talk about the symptoms of depression, which is mood, interest loss, and so forth. But before that, ladies and gentlemen, let us
write down your answer to the following question. Is there any evidence that these thoughts may not be true? Finally, write down a more helpful alternative thought. The thought log exercise can help you recognize the effect that your thoughts are having on you and help reframe them into something more positive. We hope these tips help you work through difficult emotions and encourage you to find healthy coping mechanisms that work for you. Now we want to hear from you, Psych2Goers. How do you deal with depression? Are there any routines or exercises you do that you find helpful if you're depressed? Leave your thoughts in the comments down below and take a look at the suggestions from others in the community. And always remember that your emotions are valid and you are loved and welcomed in this community. Thanks so much for watching and see you in the next video.
Hey, Psych2Goers, welcome back to another video. Did you know, if you have depression, you can help your symptoms by avoiding certain foods? There are various ways to treat depressive symptoms. The most traditional route involves talk therapy and sometimes medication. But there are other ways to help battle depression. Self-care and changing your eating habits can be helpful too. Your gut health has a far greater impact on your mental health than you may realize. Research from clinical psychopharmacology and neuroscience shows that the microbiota living in your gut communicates with neurotransmitters in your brain and vice versa via the vagus nerve. So it makes sense that what we put into our gut can impact our mental health. Here are five foods you should avoid to help your mental health. Number one, fast foods. A 2017 paper on immunology by Andrew Miller and Charles Raisin demonstrated a link between inflammation and depression. It found the release of inflammatory cytokines impinges upon the behavior of neurotransmitters and neural circuits, which results in poor behavioral functioning. Inflammation happens when something triggers an immune response. While external factors can cause inflammation in your body, food, particularly fast foods, can exacerbate it. Fast foods typically contain high amounts of refined and artificial ingredients, which make you more susceptible to depressive episodes. A 2011 paper published in Cambridge University Press found that those who consumed processed commercial baked goods were at a higher risk for depression. A similar study was published in 2016 by Springerlink regarding fried foods. Giving up these types of foods may seem a bit strict, but if you must eat processed foods, do so with moderation and sensibility. The best solution is to find healthier substitutes. Number two, alcohol. Alcohol is another thing you should avoid if you have depression. It is a depressant as it slows down your central nervous system. Because it is a small molecule, alcohol can easily cross the brain barrier and neurologically affect it. It usually contracts your brain and destroys your brain cells while it depresses your central nervous system. Additionally, it interferes between your brain receptors, which causes a disconnect between your thoughts and physical actions. Long-term consumption of alcohol can cause neurocognitive deficiencies and neurodegeneration. It's common to grab a glass of wine or champagne during celebrations, but always drink in moderation. Many people resort to alcohol as a coping mechanism. If this is the case for you, please reach out to a therapist to help you find a better and healthier way to cope with emotional distress. Number three, salt. Salt is vital when preparing food. It helps highlight the flavor of the ingredients and makes the meal taste better. Also, some salt provide minerals to our bodies. However, in some cases, salt, table salt especially, can be harmful to our health. as it is a refined salt that lacks minerals. This is the kind of salt that usually leads to high blood pressure and heart disease. Not surprisingly, salt can also cause other complications. Studies have shown that salt increases inflammation, harms gut microbiomes, and affects blood flow to the brain. The use of salt can also cause or worsen depression and impair cognitive function. So instead of dousing your food in salt, add a sprinkle. You could also try substituting your table salt for Himalayan or Celtic salt, which has more minerals than the alternative. Number 4, refined grains. Another food you should avoid if you have depression is refined grains. Unfortunately, most of our favorite foods like pizza, pasta, and cake are culprits of worsening mental health. Most commercial foods are made using refined grains, which have none to very little nutritional value. What you're mainly eating is the starchy part of the grain, the endosperm. When you eat refined grains over whole ones, you miss out on the nutrients stored in the germ and the bran. These two contain vitamins, healthy fats, minerals, fibers, and phytochemicals, necessary things that your body and brain need to function well. The endosperm primarily contains starchy carbohydrates, some proteins, and some vitamins and minerals. While most manufacturers inject the endosperm with the minerals and vitamins they initially removed, it's best to eat whole grains. A 2020 study in PubMed.gov by Deborah Gibson Smith and others found that those who ate whole grains were at lower risk for depression and anxiety disorders. So instead of reaching for a refined product like white bread or white rice, try whole wheat, wild rice, or quinoa. You never know. They might become staples in your meals. And number 5, artificial sweeteners and refined sugars. The last food group you should try to avoid if you have depression is artificial sweeteners and refined sugars. These usually come in the form of high fructose corn syrup or other substitutes like aspartame, saccharin, and acesulfame. While some of these sweeteners may not impact the calories we consume, they certainly have an impact on our health. Overconsumption of exceedingly sweet foods made with artificial sweeteners can make you shun fruits and vegetables and pursue processed foods with a similar flavor profile because sweeteners are highly addictive. A study done on lab mice proved that these sweeteners were more addictive than cocaine. Additionally,
so, ladies and gentlemen, let us proceed with our show tomorrow. And same time, same place. I love you always, forever and a day.